think most people would agree that kinos, perhaps together with slichos, comprise the more difficult portions of our liturgy to understand and to relate to. And certainly the number of kinos that we recite during the course of Tisha B'Av morning really lead to the question as to what it's all about and why we have Minhag Yisrael has developed in this fashion to really spend a good part of the morning, and even if one doesn't spend that much time reading these kinos, one poem or elegy after another, many of them written by Rabbi Zach Kalir, although not all of them, describing different tragedies. What exactly is it about? I think that perhaps Minhag Yisrael developed this way because, as I alluded to a little bit last night, we're often at a loss on Tisha B'Av as to exactly how to express our feelings. We all understand, in a general sense, the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, the fact that we're in Golos, but certainly day to day, despite the fact that it says in the beginning of the Shulchan Aruch that a person should be Meitzar Yerushalayim, should mourn and feel upset about the absence of Yerushalayim on a daily basis, and there are perhaps certain people who, certain righteous, pious people who say what they call Tikkun Chatzos, and recall and mourn and lament the absence of Beis HaMikdash on a daily or regular basis. That's not part of the routine for most of us. And at best, we think of Yerushalayim, and we think of the absence of Beis HaMikdash, and when we daven Shemoneh Esrei three times a day, and we say the Bracha of Yerushalayim, Ircha Barachim and Toshuv, or at the end of the Shemoneh Esrei, we'd say Yiratzon Tzon Sheyavana Beis HaMikdash Meherev Amenu. Maybe in benching, we say Vnei Yerushalayim Erkadosh Meherev Amenu. But by and large, other than that, most of us don't spend that much time, I suspect, thinking too much about Yerushalayim, about the missing Beis HaMikdash. Now, Kalponim, one day of the year, Tisha B'Av has been designated to do just that, and therefore we have to struggle and figure out how do we do it? How can we try and create the atmosphere or the feeling or the emotion? How do you bring up the emotion that's necessary to make this somewhat meaningful? And I think it's perhaps for that reason that the kinos, unlike other piyutim, people who study the history of Jewish liturgy know that there are piyutim that were part of Jewish liturgy in different communities throughout the centuries, most of which have not really survived to this day, at least again in the practice of most of us. In most of our shuls around here, just by way of example, the more common practice around here, I'm not saying that people don't do it, there's still many communities that do, but to say what we call Maravius on the night of Yontif, or Yotzus in the Yontif and special Shabbos davenings, like Shabbos Shkolim and so on and so forth, Shabbos HaGadol. Those piyutim have not really remained a part of the liturgy in many, many communities, and even those that do say it and then maintain, but again, the custom has been toned down at least somewhat. But the kinos have survived, and I think the reason is because we have no other means to express the emotions or to conjure up the right feelings other than through the kinos. We mentioned many times in the past, Rosh Hashanah Baruch HaDerav said that the recitation of the kinos represents, so to speak, the kumva asay, the active mourning. All the other things that we do that demonstrate avelus on Tisha B'Av are passive. We avoid doing X, Y, and Z. We avoid Talmud Torah. We avoid greeting. We avoid sitting on regular chairs and so on and so forth and wearing comfortable footwear. These are things that we, in the sense of restrictions, of avoiding. But where is the, so to speak, positive? Well, when it comes to Shabbos, when it comes to Yontif, there are other things that we do that highlight or characterize the fact that it's now Shabbos, it's now Yontif, and even a Shabbos like Shabbos Shkolin, or Shabbos HaGadol, and some of the other things that we do. And so perhaps this is just a suggestion that piyutim, which certainly enhance, and many of them are very beautiful, and I'm not dismissing them in any way, and many of our mazorim do print them, and we do say them in Rosh Hashanah Kippur, although, as you know, even Rosh Hashanah Kippur, not every community says every one of these piyutim. There are many that are printed, let's say, in the art scroll, Matzor, on the back. In some communities, and even in the regular ones, you wonder, are we part of the some, the many, the most? You know, because there are so many different practices in terms of piyutim. But again, when it comes to kinos, we need something to sort of conjure up that mood. And perhaps that's what the kinnas are for, difficult though they are, and that's why we spend time, a few minutes, trying to explain each one of the kinnas or highlight something from each one of the kinnas before we recite it, in order to give some sort of a context, and I think that that's really what we're supposed to try and do. Again, the old question that we're supposed to feel on Tisha B'Av, well, the fact is we are still in Golis. The fact is that there continue to be, from time to time, tragedies that befall the Jewish people, certainly throughout history. Whether or not they actually happened on Tisha B'Av is not the important thing. The fact is that Tisha B'Av has become designated as the day on which we recall all Jewish tragedies, whether or not they happened on that particular calendar date. There are quite a number that did, as we know, not only I mentioned last night, not only the ones that are found in the Mishnah and the Gemara, but also subsequent to that time, various other great tragedies that took place on Tisha B'Av, the expulsion from Spain, the beginning of World War I come to mind, there are many others. But even those things which did not relate specifically, or do not relate specifically to this calendar date, nonetheless have become the practice to observe them or to commemorate them on Tisha B'Av. It includes the kinnah that we say at the very end, or the two kinnahs we say at the very end, in memory of or commemorating the Holocaust, the most recent of the tremendous tragedies to befall the Jewish people, even though didn't really happen on Tisha B'Av more than any other day, other than the fact that World War I, which those who know history, was really not just World War I and World War II because it happened in that order, but you know, World War II was a direct outgrowth historically of World War I, so one can connect that to Tisha B'Av also. But even without that, it's become the practice to observe this on Tisha B'Av. So we observe Tisha B'Av, we say kinnas, the Rav pointed out, because we have many tragedies to lament, some even more recent than just this Churban HaBayis. But besides that, it is really something about the nature of the Jew and the essence of a Jewish individual in terms of his connection to historical destiny that mandates this kind of performance or this kind of activity as well. You know, on Pesach night, so we're supposed to recreate the Seder, the Yetzias Mitzrayim, not the Seder. And we say, and it's in the Haggadah, but it's from the Mishnah. In Pesachim, it says, "Bechol dor v'dor chayav odem liras esatzon kilu yatzon Mitzrayim." We're supposed to try and recreate events, to view things as though we personally came out of Mitzrayim. That's a difficult mitzvah to fulfill, but that's the one of the essential mitzvahs of the Leil HaSeder, kilu hu yatzon, or in some versions, kilu yatzon atom Mitzrayim, as if you came out right now. And not only that, but you're supposed to, according to one version of the Rambam, not only liros es atzmo, but laharos es atzmo, to demonstrate to others that you feel as though you personally came out of Mitzrayim, because it says in the Torah, "Ba'osanu hotzi misham," because Baruch Hu took us out. So I pointed out, we have a similar expression, at least a few similar words, with regards to Churban. It says, "Kol dor v'dor," any generation that did not merit seeing the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, should view it as though the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in its time, in that particular time. In other words, the fact that in our generation the Beis HaMikdash has not been rebuilt means that it would have been destroyed in our generation had it not yet been destroyed. And that really is a sobering thought, that we're not just mourning something that happened, you know, a couple thousand years ago, centuries and centuries ago, but something right now. And just like on Pesach, at the Seder, and we've pointed out in the past, it's not a coincidence, the night and day of the first day of Pesach is always the same day of the week as Tisha B'Av in that particular year. Again, this year, if you recall, Pesach Seder, the first day was Friday night, Shabbos is the first day of Pesach, so Tisha B'Av was Friday night and Shabbos. We didn't observe it because of Shabbos, but there is this connection, and the Rav developed this idea that the concept of Kol Dor V'Dor, just like this B'Chol Dor V'Dor, Chayav Adam Liros Asatzmo, there's also called Dorvador Shalom, that did not witness the building, so Midna Beis Hamikdash Biyom Kilonechor Biyomot. So there's also that notion, which I think, again, if we look at it that way, so the recitation of Kinnas becomes like a Seder, where we go through events that happened. And just like at the Pesach Seder and the Haggadah, we review all the events, or many of the major events that took place in the context of Yetzias Mitzrayim, we talk about them. So in the context of what you might call Yetzias Yerushalayim, like the piyut that we say later, contrast departing from Betzeis in Mitzrayim with Betzeis in Yerushalayim. So when we speak about Betzeis in Yerushalayim, so just like the Seder and Haggadah, we talk about and recreate those events. So too in the Kinnos, we talk about and recreate those events. So perhaps that'll give some sort of focus, so to speak, some sort of context or the lengthy recitation of the kinos, and try and talk about it and try and understand it, because we're trying to recreate that event, which again we're supposed to view as if it just happened in our own time. I think that's perhaps one way of examining the kinos. Before each kinos, I'll just try and explain a few of the lines. People should obviously you will look inside. If you have a kinos with English translation, certainly that's helpful for you. But we'll certainly try and highlight some of the major points. The first kinos that we begin with, Shavas Suru Meni Shimuni Ovrai, or in some versions Ochrai, begins with the word Shavas. Right? Shavas means, in effect, things stood still, like Shavas Einafash. Everything came to a complete standstill. By the way, I'm not going to really go into it in detail, but each one of the kinos, especially the ones by Rav Elazar Kalir, but others also, are very complicated forms of poetry, usually based on the phrases or words from Megillas Eicha. Megillas Eicha serves as the first of the kinos. In fact, in the Gemara, sometimes Megillas Eicha is called Sefer Kinos. We look in the Gemara in Bava Basra, which describes who wrote which of the books of Tanakh and the order of the books of Tanakh and so on. Megillas Eicha, we call it Eicha because that's the first word. It's the first word of several of the Prokim. Within Eicha, we call it Eicha, but in the language of Chazal, it's sometimes called and referred to as Megillas Kinos. So Eicha is the first of the Kinos. And in many of the piyutim, many of the kinos that we say are modeled in one way or after another after Megillas Eicha, in one way or another, again taking words, and each stanza begins with a different word from a different parak, all kinds of intricate patterns, which I think many of the kinos that you have with the English, whether it's a Rosenfeld edition or the Rav edition or the Arsko edition, will give you in the footnote exactly how it's organized. But in it begins with the word Shavas, and the word Shavas implies, the way the Rav understood it, sort of an unexpected or dramatic change. Everything came to an end, just like that. In fact, the Medrash tells us that Yirmiyahu HaNavi himself, who was the Navi that was alive and witnessed the Churban, Yirmiyahu himself was not even aware that the Beis HaMikdash had been destroyed. He had, when he first saw the smoke coming from the Har HaBayis, he thought it's because they had, people had done tshuva and were bringing karbanos and so on, and then all of a sudden everything, he realized that that's not exactly what happened at all. The smoke was from the burning of the Beis HaMikdash. That implies a certain sense of terror, or a certain sense of just a dramatic turnaround from the way things were. And that's a theme I think that's worth considering, because again, especially today, where we live in relative comfort, relative affluence and so on, things can change, the drop of a hat, or the turn of, whatever the expression will be, dramatically, a person's whole life. I mean, you think about, sometimes you see things in the news and so on, and you realize that, or you hear stories of somebody or someone in the community, just like that, 1 minute the person's fine and healthy and well, all of a sudden, a complete turnaround. And that's, I think, fitting for the first word of the kinos, Shavas. It means that our existence, the way we know it, life as we know it, can come to like such a dramatic stop, and things can turn around so quickly that, and uproot everything that you've been working on or thinking about or planning and relying upon for who knows how many years, can change dramatically. And that's what Hagam that Yirmiyahu HaNavi predicted and warned concerning the Churban. It wasn't a surprise, it wasn't something I hadn't expected. Nonetheless, there's this notion that all of a sudden things simply stopped and life was forever changed. And that's the opening word of this kinah, Shavas Suri Meni Shimuni Ovrai. If you look later in the kinah, it's interesting, there's a reference to the next stanza, to the Chazon Ben Berechia, the vision of Ben Berechia. Now that's a Navi. Ben Berechia was Zechariah ben Berechia, and perhaps there are many, many Nevuahs which are positive, and so one can wonder why the Paitan here, Rezek Alir, selected, I will wait for the fulfillment of the vision of ben Berechia. Okay, he was a fine Navi, but there are other Nevi'im also had beautiful words of Nechama, of comfort. Why Chazon ben Berechia? So commentaries explain this calls to mind the famous Gemara in the end of Masechet Makos, where the Kiva, was walking together with the other Tanoim, and Rabbi Akiva, when he saw the Makom HaMikdash in a state of desolation, was cheerful about it. The other Tanoim were mournful and wept. Everybody knows this Gemara. Were depressed, and Rabbi Akiva seemed to be smiling, seemed to be in a good mood. And the other Tanoim asked Rabbi Akiva, "Why you was so jolly? Why you so pleased?" And he asked him, "Why you so sad?" And they said, "What do you mean? How can we not be sad? We're looking at the place where the Beis HaMikdash once stood, and now you have animals roaming around there. How can we not be sad? There's no more Beis HaMikdash. Of course we're sad." And Rabbi Akiva said, "No, because there's a vision. There's a nevuah from Zechariah ben Berechia, who said, oh, the Yeshua Zekanim Zekanos, there will yet come a time where young people and old people will be in the streets of Yerushalayim and so on, and the city will be rebuilt, and there will be peace and tranquility in the city." But this nevuah, Rabbi Akiva pointed out, is linked to another nevuah. And I was never sure about the fulfillment of the nevuah of Zechariah ben Berechia of Od Yeshu Zekanim Zekanos, that eventually people will come back to Yerushalayim. I was never sure it was going to come true until the other nevuah came true, the other nevuah about Zion being plowed over and so on. And the Akiva said, now that I see that the dead nevuah came true, now that we look at the Makom HaMikdash, so I realize the other nevuah is going to come true as well. And the other Tanaim said in the famous phrase, Nichamtanu, right, the Akiva, you have comforted us. Well, it's a very strange passage in the Gemara, because what if Akiva didn't believe? He said, until I saw that the nevuah of destruction came true, I didn't think the other nevuah, but he doubted that the nevuah would come true. What does it mean? Rabbi Akiva didn't believe that the vision of Ben Berechia would come true. So there are different possible suggestions as to what he meant. One is that we know that many nevuahs, many passages in Navi, are allegorical. They're not meant to be taken literally. So Rabbi Akiva always wondered, is this literal, that there's going to come a time that there'll be again people in the streets of Yerushalayim? So not that he didn't believe the nevuah, he just didn't know whether or not the nevuah was meant to be taken literally, or perhaps it was representative of something that we didn't understand. Again, many prophecies are allegorical. But when he saw the other nevuah, that it came true literally, the other nevuah that's linked to this one, when he saw it was literal, right, that Zion was plowed over, the place was desolate, then he realized this is also literal. And that's why they comforted, and that's perhaps why Python, the author here, refers to this particular nevuah of all the nevuahs of comfort, because that's what Rabbi Akiva shared in that message. There's also a reference later in the Kinnah, in the next line actually, two lines later, B'Yavanis Nechuyo, a reference to the Greeks. Now, one can wonder where the Greeks fit into the picture of destruction of Churban, because the Greeks did not destroy the Beis HaMikdash. We know from the Hanukkah story that the Greeks defiled the Beis HaMikdash. They didn't destroy it. And the people who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash were the Babylonians and the Romans. So why were the Greeks mentioned here? Again, Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that the Romans were really an extension of the Greeks, and it wasn't so much in the military or physical sense, but the value system that the Greeks brought to the world. While they brought certain things which were certainly beautiful, like poetry and drama and architecture and art and things that are aesthetically appealing, but their view on the human body and their view of gods being nothing more than superhuman beings, something that stood in antithetical to Jewish values and to Jewish beliefs. And the Roman culture, as we know historically, grew out of the Greek culture, and the beginning of trouble for the Jews in terms of assimilation came with the Greeks. It's interesting that in Bavel, not that we have exact records, but we don't find references to Jews in Bavel becoming greatly assimilated. And Jews don't speak highly. You see passages in the Gemara and the Midrashim that the Jews were not fond of the Babylonian culture. The Gemara has a couple things we can learn from them about how the Suda, to eat of the Suda and so on, but by and large the Babylonians were not admired so much by the Jewish people, that there was no great fear. Again, we don't know exactly, but we don't find that there was tremendous assimilation among the Babylonians. But when the Greeks came into the picture, there we see all of a sudden so many Jews were interested in becoming like the Greeks, Hellenists, and so on and so forth. And again, we live with that today, and there's always the question of the balance between the culture around us and the Jewish tradition. So these are some of the themes of this particular kinnah. The kinnah does end with a positive note, as many of them do, again modeled after Eicha itself. Eich itself ends with a positive expressing hope for the future, and so the Kina does as well. And it says at the end, is Kadosh Baruch Hu should punish those who destroyed us, and again, it ends on this positive note. We'll say the Kina again, and after each Kina, I'll just speak, or before each Kina, I'll speak a few minutes, just by way of words of introduction and commentary. Shavasu menashu. The next Kina begins, Eicha Hatzto V'Apecho, and has as its refrain the phrase Zechor Hashem Mehoyolonu, which comes from the last parak of Megillas Eicha. Each stanza begins with the word Eicha. In fact, the next several kinos begin with the word Eicha. Again, the Rebbe is fond of pointing out that as a general rule, we don't ask that kind of question. We're not permitted to question HaKadosh Baruch Hu's decisions. How could you do this, or why did you do this? Eicha is a question we generally refrain from asking. In fact, the Mishnah, the Gemara Brachas, describes that a person is required to make a bracha and praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu, regardless of what happens, even when bad things happen. As a bracha, we say Baruch Dayan HaEmes, Kashem Shem Baruch Al HaTov, Kach Mevaruch Al HaRa. Just like we make a bracha, Baruch Hashem, on good things, we also have to make a bracha when things that are unfortunate take place, and we don't really have the right to expect to be able to understand why HaKadosh Baruch Hu may have done certain things and why he does certain things. However, Kinos on Tisha B'Av is a notable exception to this rule, because we're following the example set by Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu HaNavi said Eicha, so we are allowed, so to speak, to ask the question Eicha as well. Each of the standards, again, says, Eicha, how did you do this? This terrible punishment, whatever it may be that's referred to in each stanza. Velo zacharka, as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't remember, and each time it mentions different things. For example, it didn't remember the bris bein apsarim, or it didn't remember various other positive things which happened in early Jewish history. Interestingly enough, again, there's a contrast here between Yetzias Mitzrayim and Yetzias Yerushalayim. So, for example, in the second or third stanza, it says, "Vozacharta diligas dilu derech asher dalagta ligalecha." This refers to the quick travel that Bnei Yisrael made when they came out of Mitzrayim. They did an 11-day journey in only 3 days. That's Rashi mentioned yesterday, Sedra and Dvarim. That's what it means. Again, conjuring up Yetzias Mitzrayim, which was such a positive time, which is suddenly now forgotten. Later on, it says Vozacharta chitun chukei chorev, a reference to chorev is Har Sinai, a reference chitun to chasana, to the marriage that the lamed Har Sinai was like a marriage between Hashem and the Jewish people. The Torah tivona Moshe Moroshok Yos Yaakov, and the Chazal of the Drasha, Altikre Morosha, and the Orosha, like betrothed and engaged. And later it mentions those Acharta Oz Adi Adayim, the double crown that we were given. That's the crown of Nasa and the crown of Nishma. These are all things, how could HaKadosh Baruch Hu forget? Again, a type of question which in general we don't ask. In fact, as I said before, we're not permitted to ask. But here, we do ask it following the path or the example of Yirmiyahu. And just one other point on the phrase that's repeated as a refrain, it says Zechor Hashem Mehoyo Lanu. Okay, as the Rav pointed out, that Lanu does not necessarily mean only Lanu, we the Jewish people, but you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, also. What has happened to us together? Because we have a notion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is with us whenever there is a tsar. Imo Anochi Bitzara, HaKadosh Baruch Hu joins us when we're in a state of sorrow. He too is in a state of sorrow, and therefore we say Zechor Hashem Mehoyolonu, meaning all of us together, you and us together, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The next kina begins with the words Ad Archug Shamayim, Alei Ti Shamayim. Unusual words. Again, many of the kinas use poetic terms which are difficult. Ad Archug Shamayim means, in effect, that I would like either myself or my lamentations to soar to the heavens.
and in effect invite or enjoin the heavens to join with me in saying kinnas. I would make the heavens lament with me. And curse the day, or yom machriv hamayim, curse the day when I was destroyed two times. What is one of the themes of this particular kinna is that different elements of nature, different elements of the world, are, so to speak, join in the sorrow and lamentations of Tisha B'Av. Last night, if people paid attention, one of the piyutim that we said last night after Ma'ariv, after Niglas Eichet, at Ma'ariv, it begins Arona B'chiyah B'tzion Mispei Yerushalayim. The 12 mazalos, the 12 constellations, are depicted in that kinah as mourning for the Churban, as though the stars also were affected. And the Rav again pointed out that, in his words, the Churban was not only a historical event that affected the Jewish people, it was also a cosmic catastrophe affecting all of nature. And in some way, the world was somehow changed by the Churban. He referred, for example, to Gemara in Masechet Sota, which says that from the time of the Churban Beis Hamikdash, fruits of the tree didn't have the same flavor. And again, whether this is meant to be taken completely literally or not, the fact is that we understand that somehow there were two different worlds. There was a world with a Beis Hamikdash and a world without a Beis Hamikdash, and it wasn't the same place. It also mentions here at the beginning of the kinnah, O'or Yom Achiv Pamayim, I curse the day. And this is an important comment because within the Jewish tradition, a day itself, it's like, what do you mean cursing a day? It's not the day's fault. It's a strange expression. Why do we curse the day, the night of Av? The day didn't cause it to happen. It's what happened on the day, right? It's a strange idea. Why am I cursing this particular day? The day didn't do anything wrong. But the answer is it did. In our tradition, the Rav pointed out that a day, a period of time on a calendar, has status. It's not just something in nature. Most philosophers understand that a day does not have any, it's part of a system, and it's, a point on a number line, so to speak. But in our tradition, it's not the case. Time itself has certain attributes to it. And so therefore we have a day that's good, Yom Tov, literally, okay, we call it Yom Tov, right, or Shabbos. The day itself has Kedusha. The day is something about the day itself, the quality of the day itself. And Rachman al-San, in a bad situation like this, it's a day which is defined by bitterness and sadness, and therefore is not an appropriate, so to speak, to, if you will, curse the day when these terrible things happen. There is a phrase later in the kinnah. It says, "B'chol shana omeres hi hashana hazos." And this always moved me as one of the sort of most frustrating things, because every year we say, oh, Hashana Azos, this is the year. B'chol Shana Omeres Hi Hashana Azos. We say every year, this is the last time, this is the year. People may know that some people had a tradition that after Tisha B'Av they buried or put away the kinnas. And these little booklets and pamphlets that we have for kinnas, people would bury them and put them on Achalinim again next year, because next year the ghoul will be here and Tisha B'Av will be Yontif. Right? It says, of course, we're back again, as we discussed last night, but still, there is this notion that somehow Tisha B'Av won't have to come back. We say that every year. B'chol Shana Omeres Hi Hashana Hazos. I pointed out in the past, grammatically, people wonder, why do we say L'Shana Haba B'Yerushalayim? Why don't we say L'Shana Hazos B'Yerushalayim? And so some explain to me L'Shana Haba means next year at this time, right? Again, focusing on the day. Or sometimes the word Ba, depending on how you pronounce it, Ba'a, means the year that has come. Rachel Ba'a, or Rachel Ba'a in its own. I put an accent on the Aleph, means in the present. But whatever, we say the phrase, and it's just frustration. I think I probably pointed out in the past, I remember hearing as a young boy, my father commented once, the Seder, I'll never forget it, I don't know why it made such an impression on me, but I guess it relates to this. We were singing at the end of the Seder, Adir Hu. Right, Adir Hu, even that base of the car of Mehera, the Amen of Bekarov, Kelvinay Vishab Bekarov. I remember my father saying, how many generations of Jews have sung this song at the end of the Pesach Seder and have said, Yivna Beis of Bekarov, Bimheira, Amen of Bekarov. And that's exactly what we're saying in this kinnah, B'chol Shana Omeres Hi Hashana Hazos. Every year we think it's going to be this year, and so far we're frustrated that this year hasn't has not yet been the year of the Geula. As I said at the outset, that's because of our activities, and that's why we're sitting in St. Kinnis, because any generation in which the Beis HaMikdash was not rebuilt is considered to be as though it was destroyed in its time instead. The next Kinnah begins, Echos Sifarti Marashosai Shlichu, which refers to the Pasuk in Megillas Eicha, Hishlich Meshamayim Eretz Tiferes Yisrael, our glory and splendor has been cast down and destroyed. The Kinnah here takes Psukim from Parshas Bechukosai. The beginning of Parshas Bechukosai records the brachas that will be visited upon the Jewish people should they observe the mitzvahs properly. And of course we didn't, so instead we had the punishments. And so each stanza here says that we got what we got in place of that which we would have gotten had we been deserving of our Kodesh Baruch Hu's bracha. At one point in the Kinnah, it mentions Kitor Chupasa Hola Kakibshon, the smoke of the Beis HaMikdash goes up like the smoke from a fiery oven, and it's reminiscent of the pasuk regarding the destruction of Sodom, when Avraham Avinu said, Avraham Avinu saw the destruction of Sodom, or what was left of Sodom, the next morning after that destruction, that he went back to where he had stood, and he saw that the smoke was coming up, you know, Kitor Kibshan. And this, of course, relates to the notion that we expressed in the Haftarah yesterday, in the vision of Yeshaya, Chazon Yeshaya, of Kisdom Ayinu Lamora Dimino. We've been compared, because of our deeds, to the wicked people of Sodom and Amora, who typify evil, and that's unfortunately, what we've been condemned to as well. The second part of the Kinnah, and we're going on with the Psukim in Parsha Bechukosai, again take those psukim and say that those parts of the negative parts of the Haftocha in Parsha Bechukosai, that if we don't observe the mitzvahs we'll be punished. So indeed those psukim are highlighted as well. Towards the end of the Kinnah it says Kumi Dofi Shavi Al Dami, again a silver lining, if you will, that the author of the Piyut tells Knesset Yisrael to don't be silent, stand up, just like it says in the Megillas Eicha, Kumi Roni Valaila, cry out, and don't be silent. In other words, as many disasters as have happened to the Jewish people, nonetheless, we should not give up. It does not mean that God has abandoned us. Again, as I mentioned last night, the Od Yad and the Tuya, his hand is still outstretched, even when he punishes us, but he doesn't reject us. We still have the opportunity to daven and to pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even if the Shari Tfila, even if the gates of heavens have been sealed, so to speak, Sosam Tfilasi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't let Tfilas in, but Shari Dima, the gates of tears, have not been sealed, and tears always can come in, and therefore the Piyut says, Kumi Dovki Shavi Al Domi, knock and bang, and petition HaKadosh Baruch Hu if you can, and perhaps all the decrees will be overturned. The next Kinnah begins with the words Eicha Yosra Chavatzelas HaSharon, which is a description, Chavatzelas HaSharon, description of the Jewish people. The specific focus of this particular Kinnah is the families of the Kohanim. The Kohanim, as we know, have been divided into 24 families. You don't need all the Kohanim in the Beis HaMikdash all the time. And so eventually, Chof Dalad Mishmaros, 24 shifts of Kohanim were established, and they worked in the Beis HaMikdash on a rotational basis. In other words, each family came in for a particular time, for a week, and then the next family would come in again on a rotational basis. You're all together 24 families, 24 mishmaros, 24 groups, and again, it's all described in the Gemara in the end of Maseches Tainis. And basically, it meant that the Kohanim were most of the year not in Yerushalayim, were not in the Beis HaMikdash. There were 24 families, 50 plus weeks in a year, so obviously it was only about 2 weeks out of the year that the Kohanim were needed in the Beis HaMikdash. And so there were cities which were set up where the Kohanim lived during the course of the year. Sometimes cities which had all Kohanim in it, other times where Kohanim lived together with other people. And this particular kinneh makes reference to the names of all the families, all the groups. And by the way, not all of them are known from the Gemara. This kinneh seems to be, the Rav pointed out, is the one source that we have for all the 24 names. Some of them are mentioned in Sukkot and Gemara and so on, and so some of the cities are mentioned in Psukim as being cities of Kohanim, but others don't mention it here. Others aren't mentioned anywhere but here. So just a historically interesting kinneh. Why focus on the Kohanim so much? Well, there are two reasons. One is because the Kohanim again represents service of the Beis Hamikdash. So for mourning the absence of the Beis Hamikdash, it's only natural that we should refer to the Kohanim. But also because the Kohanim were the ones who fought very valiantly against the Romans. The Medrash tells us in Eicha Rabbah that the Kohanim fought, you know, really bitterly against the Romans to try and prevent the destruction. We pointed out in the past that in as much as the walls of the old city of Yerushalayim were breached on Shavuos HaBetamuz, so it shouldn't take 3 weeks. It takes about, 10 minutes or so to walk from the outside of the wall to the Temple Mount, to the Kos HaMoavim, 10 minutes, 15 minutes at most. And the soldiers make a little more time, but 3 weeks. It took 3 weeks to get from the breaking of the wall to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. The answer is because the Kohanim fought every single step, and they were the sort of the valiant fighters that tried as much as possible to keep the Romans out of the Beis HaMikdash, despite being outmanned and outgunned and everything else. Nevertheless, this kinneh therefore serves a little bit as a tribute to the Kohanim who fought, and not only again represented service of the Beis HaMikdash, but represented defense, so to speak, of the of Yerushalayim, defense of the Beis HaMikdash as well. Eicha Yoshua, Chavat Shalosh Hashemar. The next kinneh of Ayikone Yirmiyahu Al Yoshua Eicha El Ikonu Me'elov is a eulogy which Yirmiyahu Navi gave in memory of the king Melech Yoshiyahu, was killed in Megiddo. Just to go over the story very quickly, Yoshiyahu was a righteous melech. In fact, in some ways, there was no other king as great as he, other than David HaMelech himself. And Yoshiyahu had a campaign of religious reform, which he instituted in Eretz Yisrael to try and clean up the mess which was left behind by the previous king, including the wicked king Manasseh, who lived in a time or created a situation where people worshipped Avodah Zarah and Molech, a child sacrifice, all kinds of terrible things. Yoshiyahu tried to overturn all of that and was a righteous king, but made a tragic mistake by not listening to Yirmiyahu later in his life, and he did not want to let Paro Necho, the king of Egypt, bring troops through Eretz Yisrael, even though the original plan was not to attack Eretz Yisrael. He just wanted to bring troops through, but Yirmiyahu didn't allow it because the Pasuk says, "B'cherem lo savar ba'artzechem," that even when things are good, Kadosh Baruch Hu will see to it that no armies march through your land, even if they're just passing through. No sword, no military will come through. Yoshiyahu made a mistake in evaluating the people. He thought that he had this religious reform that was so successful that everybody had turned around, and he wasn't quite correct. Unfortunately, many of the people did not follow his reform, at least did not follow it fully. And Yirmiyahu advised Yoshiyahu to let Paro bring his soldiers through. He didn't listen to Yirmiyahu, and the battle ensued, and he was killed in this particular battle. Now, the Rav like to point out that one of the purposes of this kinneh, in addition to remembering the great king Yoshiyahu, is also to give a different focus to the kinnehs in general. Usually the kinnehs were focusing on the communal disaster, the communal tragedy, the suffering of the Jewish people as a nation, the loss of the Beis HaMikdash and everything, but we cannot lose sight of the suffering of individual people. I pointed this out in past years, and it's something to stress. People who suffered were human beings. You know, fathers and mothers, brothers, sisters, sons, daughters, and so on, and people underwent terrible pain. And sometimes when you look at an event which took place some time ago, and you look at it, it had such global implications that you forget the individual implications. And that the theme we'll come back to, but that's a part of what's going on over here with Yoshio, a great man, a great leader. Aside from the communal suffering that the base Korban base Hamikdash resulted in, there's also individual suffering that took place, and I want you to never lose sight of the individual suffering. Moreover, there is a notion, of course, that Shkula Mises and Shul Tzadikim Kisreifas Beis Elokeinu, right? The Gemara mentions that in Rosh Hashanah, that the death of the righteous is like the loss of the Beis Hamikdash. Why is that so? Because a righteous person, a successful leader, brings the Shekhinah to Klal Yisrael also. Yoshio certainly was responsible for bringing people closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through his religious reforms, even if it wasn't completely successful. And the purpose of the Beis Hamikdash is to give people an opportunity to connect, so to speak, with the Shekhinah, and therefore the death of a righteous person like that is considered comparable to the loss of the Beis Hamikdash. The first stanza says, "Ben Shmona Shana Hechel Idrosh Melokav." He took over the throne as a child, as a young boy. He was 8 years old, and his whole story is an interesting story of how he got there. We don't know what inspired him to start this tshuva movement, so to speak. But the Kina says, "Lokam Kamohu Mivos Avigdor." Okay, Avigdor is another name for Moshe. Okay. It says that nobody was a leader like him since the days of Moshe. However, Davak Bochet Leitzane Hador. However, the wise guys of the generation, unfortunately, did him in because they were not. He was not successful for as much as he wanted to in terms of getting rid of Avodah Zarah. There were people who outwardly sort of demonstrated they had given up Avodah Zarah, but secretly they continued to worship, and again he didn't realize this, and in a certain sense paid the ultimate price by being killed in a battle, and he was killed in a most unpleasant way. It says towards the end of the Kina, he became like a target that the target in a bow and arrow contest. And he was the target. He was shot with so many arrows. The Kina says, "Vayizirku vo shlosh meos kitim." He was hit with 300 arrows, and therefore certainly he suffered in this terrible fashion. Of course, the people recognized the greatness of Yoshio, but this Kina, which was composed. Not this, I mean, a kina was composed by Yirmiyo. A eulogy was written stated by Yirmiyo, and that's what this kina focuses on. By Kohen Yirmiyo al Yoshio. Begin the kina now. Echa Eli Konu Meilo Ben Shmona Shona Chelagosh. The next kina, Oli Asher Ta'avta Lo Bereishis, means. Refers to the Beis Hamikdash as the tent or the place which HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, desired or planned even before Bereishis. And this refers to the Gemara that a number of things were created even before the world came into existence, including Torah, Tshuva, Gan Eden, Gehenim, the Kisar Kavod, the Beis Hamikdash, and Mashiach, or the name of the Mashiach. In other words, the Beis Hamikdash was already something that was a reality and part of the cosmos, as it were, even before the world was created. It was not just a building that was built by Shlomo Melech and subsequently rebuilt. Okay, a Beis Hamikdash was where HaKadosh Baruch Hu had in mind or in plan from the very time of the creation of the world. In fact, the whole world, so to speak, the whole universe was, in effect, a Beis Hamikdash. Once there was sin in the world to Adam Rishon, so it did not function as a Beis Hamikdash anymore, but it returned in the bias which HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose and built by Shlomo HaMelech, that became the place of the Beis HaMikdash. But that's the reference here to Oli Asher Ta'avta Ad Lo Bereishis.
One of the words that keeps repeating itself at the end of each stanza is the word po. The word po means here, refers to a destination. And idea is that the Beis HaMikdash, or the connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is a destination. You've come here, you've reached something. And a number of different psukim using those, or phrases from Chazal using that word po, is repeated throughout this kina. At the very end of the kina, again a note of positive refuasi betucha ki rega biapo. My healing is promised. And again, we have that faith despite all the disaster. Refuasi betucha. My healing is guaranteed, so to speak. Ki rega biapo. Because Baruch's anger is really only for a moment, and therefore we end on that positive note in this particular kina as well. Oh, Yashir to Avdal Arajas. The next kina, Eko, of course, contains a play on the word Echa. The word Ko, which means so or such, is found identifying many, many of the heroes of Tanakh, starting with Avraham Avinu himself. The word Ko is used in reference to a discussion with him, Ko Ye Zaracha, with Yitzchak, the reference to the Akedah, when he set up the deal with Lavan to get the speckled and the spotted animals, the word Ko. Moshe Rabbeinu, in the beginning of his career, Vayifen Ko Vacho, quite a number of different things, not only individuals, later on Yahushua is mentioned, but also the Jewish people. Things happened where the word Ko plays a role, as a reference, for example, to Birchas Kohanim, which begins with the word Ko Savarchu Espanei Yisrael. So this kina asks over and over again, A Ko, where are all these haftachas, all these promises related to the word Ko? And we haven't seen, or we're missing the fulfillment of all those promises with the word Ko. And the Soloveitchik pointed out an additional point, that the word Ko represents something beyond. He said that Ko, in effect, represents a sense of emunah, almost a believing in something beyond. And that's hinted at in the pasuk regarding Yitzchak and the Akedah. When Avraham was walking with Yitzchak and his servants, he told the servants, Shulachem Poim Achamor, you stay here with the donkey, Vani Vanar Nelcha Ad Ko. I and the young man Yitzchak will proceed to Ko. And the word Ko again refers to something beyond, something not here, as opposed to in the previous kinnah, the word was Po, a reality, something right here in front of us. The word Ko means something beyond, and it represents, as the Rav pointed out, some sort of an emunah that is difficult to understand. Most people want to know what's in front of me right now, what's here and now, to deal with what's in front of us. You know, can't deal with the abstract of things down the road that don't exist yet. Right now, what's here now? I want to see it now. I want to know immediately what it is, what I'm getting, what it's about. We want that instant kind of gratification. And in the realm of emunah, there has to be emunah, the things that we don't see, things we don't understand. Also, work out, so to speak, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu orchestrates things that maybe we don't understand things until much further down the road. In the meantime, we just say, we believe it's such that it is, even if we don't see it. Right, and that's the notion here by Nivanar Nelcha Ad Ko. But again, that's not true with all of the introductions. Some of them, again, are just words, Ko, Soma, Leves, Yaakov, etc., referring to Latin Torah or Rabifus Konim. And again, this Kenneth simply asks, what happened to all these beautiful Haftachas of Ko? Instead, we suffer, and the Haftachas are not being brought to bear. Eko, Merkur, the Rizvan. The next tune begins with Echas, Asher, Kvar, Osuhu. I mentioned before that the Beis HaMikdash was identified as existing in a certain sense even before the world was created, but at the same time there is this notion that the fact that the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed was also known from before, and time of Nisan B'Reishis was already, so to speak, foretold, and that the Nevi'im were aware of this in some sense, that the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed, eventually rebuilt, they didn't know when. But that's the reference here in the opening stanza. Bonoi v'charavu bonoi. Right, they understood that it was built and then it would be destroyed, but again would be rebuilt. And that's the theme of this kina, that everyone knew, the avos and so on knew about this before it even happened, that this was going to be the destiny. Of course, they didn't know exactly when it would take place. This kina too, it's a somewhat of a long kina, but it ends with a positive. It ends with a positive point. It says, "Al nezev al mazeh kino ko yachad zomer v'chol zomer v'chol roga rogdul hamir l'shon eichab l'shon eiko." You know, when eichab becomes eiko, a request for the eiko, which seems to indicate that this kind of probably should have preceded the one we said before, which indeed it does in some editions. You know, it ends on that note, not on a positive note, but on a note of referring to the Haftachos of Ko. We just discussed that in the previous kina. So for whatever reason, in most editions that we have, this kina ends with the reference to Eicho and the play on words to Eicho that we just said in the previous kina. Nonetheless, again, the idea of Bonoi, Chorav Bonoi, the Akrit, that eventually the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt. Eicho Seshe Chorav. And the next kina, Eicho Hashposo Pasuach Kever, I'm not going to talk about much. It's a very, very long kina because it follows the third perek of Megillas Eicho, which is the perek of the Megillah that has three lines or three psukim for each letter of the Aleph Beis. The perek Aleph and Beis and Dalet of Megillas Eicho has one pasuk per letter of the Aleph Beis, so 22 psukim altogether. The third perek has 66 psukim. There are three letters for each of the three psukim for each of the three letters, for each of the each individual letter, and so this kind of follows that, but it also weaves in the various other prokim also in an intricate way, and includes a line from the Tochacha. For example, Ve'beis Aleichem Cherev, each man of the standards end with references to things from the Tochacha, from other tragedies. So again, a very intricate and long kina, we'll say it again without much introduction, just to save a little time. Echash poso pasuk the kever levonim. The next kina, number 16, zechor asher oso tzar b'fenim, is a reference to Roman general Titus, who destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash, but didn't just destroy the Beis HaMikdash, but actually came into the Kodesh HaKodoshim and defiled the place in the most terrible fashion. He brought a zona, brought a prostitute into the Kodesh HaKodoshim and had his way with her there and so on, and the kina raises the question of how HaKadosh Baruch Hu could tolerate such behavior, especially in light of the fact that Nadav and Avihu, you know from the Chumash, came in for the purpose of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and because they came into the place inappropriately, the wrong timing and so on, without being commanded to do so, they were struck down immediately. Here, instead of being subjected to this atrocious behavior of Titus, who entered the Beis HaMikdash with a sense of arrogance and so on, wasn't punished at all. How could such a thing possibly happen? Now, the Romans, of course, had great military power, and it appears that there's a reference in the Kinnah, for example, to Mitzrayim v'cholom asher bom gavar. General Titus and the Romans were able to destroy pretty much every army and every nation that was possibly in their way because of their great military capabilities, and that's why it became the great Roman Empire. There is evidence that the Romans originally were not necessarily planning to destroy the Jewish people and the Jewish kingdom. Their objectives were more in the political realm, to assume political control, but not necessarily to destroy it. And therefore, it wasn't until the Bar Kokhba revolt, which was in more than 50 years after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, that the Romans really decreed, many of these terrible decrees against the Jews came after the after Bar Kokhba. What the Romans really hoped is that the Jews would assimilate into Roman culture and accept the Roman rule, Roman culture, Roman law. And the Jewish people were pretty much the only ones of their vanquished peoples that refused to do so. Titus assumed that when he would conquer the Beis HaMikdash, wouldn't just be tearing down the actual Beis HaMikdash itself, but it would be a victory over the spiritual and religious tone of the Jewish people. And eventually they would assimilate, that's what he assumed, into the Roman society, because the Roman culture and Roman law was so powerful and so attractive and so pleasing to people that you could leave the Jews alone and they'll eventually assimilate. Of course, it didn't happen. In fact, the Bar Kokhba revolt, again, more than 50-60 years after the destruction of Beis HaMikdash, showed the Jewish people were simply not accepting the Roman law, the Roman culture, as Titus accepted. And it was later then that the Romans recognized that the Jews have a spiritual identity which is not dependent upon a king or even upon a Beis HaMikdash. But in any event, Titus assumed that, would be the case, but he came into the Beis HaMikdash with a plan to, so to speak, mock it and to render it sort of almost powerless. In a certain sense, that's how the Jewish people certainly must have felt, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, was not able to help, and that's why it says toward the end of the Kinnah, "V'hu asur bazikim." It's as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu was bound up in chains. He couldn't do anything. Toward the end of the Kinnah, it says, "Al tzad ma'arovi lezecher hisri bo." That there's one side, the western side, a remnant was left behind, and that's the reference we can presume to the Kosel Hamaravi, to the western wall, which we know is such an important site to us. It's interesting, Rav Soloveitchik made the observation, and I'm not sure what he said or what to make of it, but the fact is that as important as the Kosel Hamaravi, the western wall, is to us in our Jewish life today, so we go to Eretz Yisrael, it's not really mentioned in the Gemara. There's no references in the Gemara to the Kosel Hamaravi as being a place of Kedusha. There are Mishnayos and Maseches Kelim which speak about 10 levels of Kedusha. So yes, the wall is the wall around the Azara and so on, so you have progressive Kedusha from Eretz Yisrael to walled cities, to Yerushalayim, to the Azara, to the Kodesh, and so on and so forth, different places in the Beis HaMikdash. But I don't think there are references to the Kosel Hamaravi per se as being a place of Kedusha mentioned in the in the Gemara. There are perhaps references in Medrash, but this is actually a pretty clear reference. Atzad Maravi Lezecher Sibol Atzad Achar Koslenu, it even refers to it as our wall, our Kosel, as a place where Kodesh Baruch Hu would demonstrate a certain amount of mercy, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be in that place. Shekhinah will never leave that place, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu eventually will return to that place, and that's again why we treat it with such reverence and such importance today. Continue with the Kinnah Zechorah, Asher Oso Tzar B'Kinnah. The next Kinnah, Im Tochalma Moshim, Piryam Olei Tibuchim Alalai Li, has as its reference the words Alalai Li, meaning woe is to me, so to speak. It's a cry of sadness and frustration, describing terrible things which are all based on Midrashim. These are not fictional, it's personal tzaras of the Churban. I mentioned before that we tend to lose sight of the fact sometimes when we think about a national tragedy, the individuals who suffered. I happen to see, in some of the news outlets in the last week or so, after the shooting in the movie theater in Colorado. So, the X number of people died, but they seem to go out of their way this time. I don't know if I noticed it in the past, but, there were a number of different portraits of the lives of the individuals that were lost. And I think it's valuable to do that because it reminds us these anonymous numbers. And there was whatever number it was, a dozen or 15 people, certainly a tragedy. And certainly when we're considering 6 million people, let's say, from the Holocaust, and we just throw the number around, And we don't even recognize that, you know, these were people, these were human beings who had aspirations and goals and lives and the loved ones and so on. And especially when reflecting back on a tragedy that happened long, long ago, when none of us know any of the people, we can't appreciate the people and so on, we don't have any connection with them on a personal basis. So we lose sight, we simply say X number of people were killed, this great tragedy happened, and but sometimes the best we can do. On the other hand, the Paitan here, Bazar Kalir, goes through the Midrashim and takes stories of actual suffering of actual people. So there's a reference here in Tavashon Rachmoni Alben Amadudim Tfachim Tfachim. So there's a story in the Gemara about a wealthy woman who measured the growth of her child every day, and for each amount that he grew, each tefach, let's say, each few inches that he grew, she would contribute to the Beis Hamikdash. And at the end, this child died, and she had to consume his flesh. The terrible tragedy. I mentioned in the past, it says, "V'sikashan l'susim porchim." There's a story in the Medrash as well, the Echarabo, that Miriam Baspices, a certain woman, was tied to the back of a horse and was dragged by the horse, and the horse began to run away. So she was killed by, you know, by being bounced against the ground and so on, the force of the horse. I've mentioned in the past that Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that this didn't just happen 2,000 years ago or 1,900 years ago, but he said during the Holocaust, a cousin of his, the Rav said, a cousin of his who was related to him to Chaim, he had newly married when the Nazis came into Warsaw, and they tied him to a car, and they tied his wife to another car, drove off at high speed, and this resulted in their death. So this is something that happened to Soloveitchik, to somebody that he knew, to a cousin of his and his young wife, who were tortured to death in this fashion by the Nazis. So there's reference in here that this happened in the time of the Churban HaBayit, not with cars, but with horses. And again, quite a number of different descriptions of the suffering of individuals. Again, you can't lose sight of that. There's also a reference in here, as we already had in a number of the kinnas, some of you may have noticed, relating to salty food. We mentioned that when the Jewish people ran away from Eretz Yisrael, so some of them fled towards today's Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, and when they wanted water, instead got very salty and sharp, were given salty and sharp food, which was just a form of torture when somebody wants wants to drink water. So all of these things are terrible personal experiences, ending with the words "Alalai Li." However, there is at the very end a reference to something that comes in a later kina. Kadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, responds, if you will, and says, "Well, you're all saying woe is unto me, and woe is me because of all this great suffering." But I notice that you don't mention any of the things that you did, namely in Yehareg Mikdash Hashem Kohen V'Navi, a reference to the killing of the Navi Zechariah, which is a later kinnah. But that's what Kadosh Baruch Hu complains here, so to speak, to the Jewish people. You're busy saying all the terrible things that happened to you, you don't acknowledge the things that you did, and that's going to represent a shift in some of the kinnas, as we'll see in a short while. Again, we continue now with kinnah number 17, Yud Zayin, in Tochalma Moshim Pirma, Leiti Bukhim. The next kinnah, Yud Ches, begins with Atal Marta, Heitev, Heitev, Moch, and there is each standard sort of begins with the word Atah, things that you are Kadosh Baruch Hu did or promised, and therefore continues, the second half of the stanza continues with Lama, and so therefore why did all these bad things happen? It's a contrast again that Kadosh Baruch Hu made us certain promises, and for example the opening of Atah Marte Tevi Tivima, so Lama B'nei B'liyah Chilu Shema, why did all these terrible things happen? Again, each stanza like that, things which you did Kadosh Baruch Hu set up and established, and then you let so many terrible things happen. Now, the Rav pointed out that the background to this kina is the notion of bris avos. Okay? We have two different concepts in the halacha, or in the Gemara. We have bris avos and zchus avos. Zuchus refers to the merit, but the merit can run out. Zuchus Avos can run out. You know, so, how many times can you call the same favor? And sometimes a relationship with somebody, or someone has a relationship with my father, with my mother, so they'll give me a break. But after a while, Zuchus Avos, Thomas Zuchus Avos, it runs out. But Bris Avos, a deal is a deal. Bris is a covenant. A Bris Avos should never, will never be able to run out, and therefore, that's a little bit the argument here. Because Baruch Hu established a bris, established something with the Jewish people, and yet nonetheless, so many terrible things were permitted to be were permitted to happen. Zchus Avos runs out because we're not carrying on the path of our Avos. Okay, but when it says Ato Amarte Tevei Tivimach at the beginning, Kadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, made a deal. It's a legally binding, and therefore we say to our Kadosh Baruch Hu, you know, please turn it around. For example, we say in the Slicha, Zechor Lano Bris Avos Kasher Amarto. We don't refer to Zchus Avos, we refer to Bris Avos, and that's the motif of this particular kina as well, starting with Ato Amarto. You notice the kinnah which we just finished ended with sort of an admission of guilt. After asking all these questions we asked in the previous kinnah, the lama, the next kinnah provides the answer. And as I said before, there's a bit of a shift. Because until now we've been asking, Eicha, how could such a thing happen? How could Hakadosh Baruch Hu do this to us? And why did he allow this to happen? And he made a bris with us, and all these things that we presented, so to speak, as tainas, as it were, as objections to Hakadosh Baruch Hu, which, as I said earlier, is something we're generally not allowed to do. Since Yirmiyahu did it, Megillas Eicha, we're going to do it too. But now we come a little bit to the answer, and as an admission that, well, in a certain sense, we're certainly deserving of all of this. The previous kinnah had actually 11 questions, and here we have answers to all those questions. The Chashem Atzdaka V'lana Boshas Aponim, which is the theme. The Chashem Atzdaka discusses all the good things that Kadosh Baruch Hu did. V'lana Boshas Aponim, we're ashamed because we did that which we did. So here we have a little bit of notion of Hakaras HaChet, so to speak, which is part of the tshuva process. It's interesting, just psychologically, you know, Eicha, as I mentioned before, at the start of the kin of Shabbat, when something dramatic happens, so the immediate reaction is shock and disbelief. How could such a thing be? But upon reflection, as I said at the outset, the recitation of kinnas perhaps are similar to the recitation of the Haggadah. There's a progression, and the more we talk about, the more we look into it, the more we begin to see certain things. And that's really the theme of the kinnah. And it's a psychologically true thing as well. Sometimes something happens and you can't believe it, you're angry about it, you're upset about it, and then as time goes on, you think about it, then you begin to realize what caused it. It can happen at work, it can happen at home, when, you know, and it can happen in a relationship, it can happen in a business deal, where something didn't work out exactly the way you thought it was going to, and you initially you can't believe it, can't figure out how could such a thing be, and you get angry about it, and then when you have time to reflect, and you realize maybe I didn't do this right, I didn't do that right, I forgot to make this arrangement. Again, we can apply it to many, many different avenues, and many different walks of a person's life. Well, that's certainly what happens, sort of the change of tenor that is related, that is evident in this particular kinnah of Lecha Hashem, Hatzdaka, and so on. And that's why we say, we remain guilty. And it's again, it's that exact thing that I said before. Kol Dor and a generation, which the Beis Hamikdash was not rebuilt in its times, as it was destroyed in its times, and that we say that here also. We say, Anu Nechom, we remain guilty to this particular day. So I said before, this kinnah represents a shift and an admission of shortcomings on our part, which in fact led to the destruction. The Lecha Hashem Atzdaka, Hashem Baruch Hu did so many positive things, and again, you could talk about each one of these things, all references to different events, but at the end, Lano Boshes HaPonim, at the very end, Hatelo Kai Oznecho Shema, we ask Hashem Baruch Hu to a turn, because we recognize we don't have tzidkus, we have boshes upon him. On the other hand, because we're so embarrassed and we're so ashamed, we're eager to come back, and that's when we end our tale of ties to Choshmo, which will lead into the following kinnah. Again, L'cho Hashem Estor. So the next kinnah number 20, Chof, our tale of Kai Oznecho. So now we petition HaKadosh Baruch Hu to listen to our, so to speak, our attempt to accept some of the blame. This is the end of a unit of Kinnas by Beleza Kalir. The theme of the Kinnah, again, is our Kosh Baruch Hu should listen to our Tfilos and Sonatala Kai Oznecho, but not just listen to our Tfilos, but to see what is being done to us even today by our enemies. This refers to, and the Rav understood this, and that seems to be so sorry for many of the words, a reference to the Christians who persecuted the Jews on the numerous different occasions, and it resulted in the Chil Shem Shamayim. In other words, we lament in this kinnah the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself was subjected to embarrassment, so to speak, by letting our enemies come into the Beis HaMikdash and to do whatever they want to us. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself that, in a certain sense, is mistreated, not just the Jewish people. I said before about Imo Anochi Betzara, but besides that, there's just the notion of Kadosh Baruch Hu, the notion of Chil Hashem, and that's a hidden theme, so to speak, of the whole Korban process. The notion of Chil Hashem, especially in terms of the Christian religion, so the belief that the Jews were condemned to be a wandering people and a suffering people because of their religious beliefs. Is something which continues down to this day, and other religions also. They point to the fact, or pointed until the mid 1900s, to the fact that the Jews didn't have their own homeland. They were always citizens of another religion, of another country. There were people without a land. That's why the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 was such a dramatic sort of event, not only obviously for the Jewish people, but for others who have always viewed the suffering and wandering Jews as testament to those who cling to this old religion. Rav Soloveitchik reported himself sometimes coming on the train down in the 1940s when the Holocaust was going on and Jews were being massacred and slaughtered in Europe. He said he was approached by missionaries who said, "Don't you see what's going on? Don't you see what's happening to your people? Obviously God has abandoned them," and so on. And that's a tremendous notion of not only suffering for the Jewish people, feel ashamed, and that's one of the themes of this kinnah. But again, I ask that Kodesh Baruch Hu to turn to us and to take note of what has taken place. The next kinnah, 21, Chafal of Arze Alavonon, is one of the most famous of the kinnahs because it relates to one of the most famous stories in Jewish tradition, and that is the story of the Asara Harugei Malchus, the 10 martyrs, referred to here as Arzei Halavonon, like cedars of Lebanon, the powerful trees. These were the story of the great Rabbanim who were executed and tortured to death by the Romans. The story of the Asara Malchus, from a historical point of view, is subject to a great deal of analysis because the concept that these 10 people were somehow brought together and executed together is very, very suspect, but particularly because they didn't all live at the exact same time. The fact that there was persecution of Gedolei Torah by the Romans, that, however, is documented. That's known. The idea that's depicted even more, we mentioned Asara Gamalchus and Kippur as well in the Avodah Eila Eskara towards the end of the end of Musaf. It's actually a more detailed description there than here. The Arzei Halavonon is a shorter description of it. In fact, in this particular kinnah, the Arzei Halavonon, only 8 martyrs are actually mentioned, not Asara Harugei Malchus, but 8 of them are mentioned. The Yehuda ben Dama is not mentioned, Rechinah ben Chachinai is not mentioned. You look at different historical accounts of the Torah Gemalchus. There are different references exactly who they were. But again, the historical account is not what's important necessarily, but rather what it represented. And that is that the Romans understood. They were surprised, as I mentioned before, the Rav pointed out, the Romans were surprised when after the Churban, the Jews did not assimilate into their society. They kind of figured that once we've destroyed their religious and cultural center, so eventually they'll become like us, which was originally their goal. They weren't interested necessarily in wiping out the Jewish people. They said that didn't happen until after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, some 60 plus years or so after the Churban. But the originally the plan was that, you know, they'll conquer the land, and then eventually the people will simply assimilate and become part of our culture. That didn't happen. And the Romans realized that one of the reasons it doesn't happen is because the Jews still have their Torah leaders, their scholars, their Talmid Chachamim, who are guiding the people even in a time of exile. The Romans understood that, and therefore went ahead to take away. They figured if we can get rid of their Torah scholars, we can get rid of their leaders, their Torah leaders, then we'll be able to finally vanquish them as an independent people. In other words, the strength of the Jew at the end of the day was not and is not dependent on Beis HaMikdash. It's a staggering comment, but an important comment. We exist today, and we've existed for close to 2,000 years, in the absence of the Beis HaMikdash. That's a sobering and important thought to bear in mind today. As much as the Beis HaMikdash is so important, as much as we mourn on Tisha B'Av the loss of the Beis HaMikdash and everything that it represented, the fact is the Jewish people have survived for all these centuries without a Beis HaMikdash, longing for it, wanting it, studying about it, learning, you know, Mishnayos and Gemaras that talk about the Beis HaMikdash. But at the end of the day, the Jewish people have survived without the absence of the Beis HaMikdash. How have they then survived if not with the Beis HaMikdash? And the answer is, it's the Torah and the mitzvahs which keep the Jewish people in existence, and not a particular place, as important as that place may be. And so the Romans understood that if you can get rid of their ability to cling to Torah, they realized the way to do that is to get rid of their Torah leaders, so then that's the way to vanquish them. We know from the story of the presentation in Kippur that a connection was drawn between the sale of Yosef, okay, whose 10 brothers sold him, and the emperor, according to the version of Yom Kippur, wanted to have these 10 rabbis stand trial in place of the 10 brothers of Yosef who sold him, and because they said that until the time of Yosef's brothers, until now there were never 10 people like you. Again, this is a dramatization in terms of its historical accuracy, but the fact that it does connect to Yosef and his brothers tells us something else which has always plagued the Jewish people, and that is a lack of the people getting along. The brothers sold Yosef, and very often the Talmid Chachamim don't recognize each other, don't get along with each other, and that, as I mentioned yesterday in the Drush and Shul, you don't have leaders that are able to function properly as leaders, so that too is something that's worth mourning. And the Romans understood, again, if you get rid of the effective leaders, then you'll be able to vanquish the Jewish people. And that's what this kin is about. Again, the concept of martyrdom. It fits in with the theme we mentioned before of not forgetting the individual suffering with regard to the time of the Churban. Again, the notion that the death of the righteous is considered like the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, in the sense that both both relate to the Shekhinah, and give us the opportunity to connect with the Shekhinah, and therefore when the Beis HaMikdash is gone or people were the people are suffering and so on, so it's the same notion that the absence of such people brings us to the absence of the Shekhinah. Arzei Halavono. The next kina, like the one we just finished, has also nothing to do particularly with Tisha B'Av or the Churban Beis HaMikdash. The next kina refers to an event much, much later in history, and that is the Crusades, which in this kina number 22 begins Hachrisha Men of Adabera, and it describes the tremendous suffering in the days starting in the year 1096, when the first crusade
again, it's not clear exactly which crusade it's referring to, but there are more than one. But the bottom line is that this is a reference to that period, again, a period of time much later than the Korban Beis HaMikdash, and again, having nothing to do with the date, the calendar date of Tisha B'Av as well. Just to understand a little bit about the Crusades, as we'll see in subsequent kinnas as well, many of the Jews who perished in the Crusades died in the time of Iyar and Sivan, Shua's time. That's because the Crusades generally tended to set out for their quest to conquer the Holy Land, to march from Europe to the Holy Land. They set out during the springtime when the roads were better and they didn't have rains and snow to contend with. And that's when they started to march. And so during the springtime, in the months of Iyar and Sivan, is when they came through Jewish communities and and did their deeds there, massacred people there. Again, this is discussed not only referred to in this kinnah, but in other kinnahs as well. The idea is what they thought is here they were going to the Holy Land to try and get rid of the non-believers there, and they thought, well, we got Jews right here, why not take care of them as well? Again, it's not specific reference to the Crusades, but there is reference here to people slaughtering their children, parents having to kill their own children to save them from the torture, and this is something we know took place during the time of the Crusades. The fact we don't have exact details is self-striking because, sadly, it could have applied to more than one occasion. In other words, here you have a kinnah which doesn't mention specifically which event or which torture or which community and so on is being addressed, and yet the kinnah exists because sadly we're able to possibly apply it to many, many different situations. Again, it's assumed that it's during the time of the Crusade because that's when we know we had this situation where parents had to kill their children rather than see them fall into the hands of the enemy. And again, there'll be a number of other kinnahs which are more clearly referring to Crusades than this one, but this is as it introduces that, although the next kinnah afterwards goes back to an earlier event. But again, these events didn't necessarily take place on Tisha B'Av, but we mourn them on Tisha B'Av as a day of collective mourning for the Jewish people. The next kinnah, number 23, goes back and discusses a story from the time of the Churban Bayis Sheni, which is recorded in the Gemara in Gittin and the Medrash, of the son and daughter of Rabbi Shmuel, Ben Abbas of Yishmuel, each of whom was captured or taken by a different Roman, and these two young children, the son and the daughter, did not know that the other one was living nearby, and the two masters wanted to arrange a marriage between the two slaves. He had a male slave, he had a female slave, so he set up that they were going to marry them, and they both died in each other's arms, so to speak, when they realized who it was. Again, the kinnah seems to be a little bit out of place here, once we already started talking about the Crusades. Nonetheless, as Soloveitchik pointed out again and again, the kinnahs seek not to forget the individual suffering. And even as we're in the midst of describing, let's say, the Crusades, when so many thousands of Jews were killed for the major calamity and so on, here you have two youngsters who are not necessarily important people in their own right. The father of Yishmael was a great leader, but he was already killed, and we don't know much about the children or whatever became of them and so on. They're just a young man, a young woman, who were not necessarily leaders and not necessarily scholars and didn't play any major role in terms of a public position and so on. Nonetheless, we can't forget, we can't lose sight of the individual, and perhaps that's why this particular kinnah is inserted here. But even as we speak about the suffering of the many, of the tzibur, again, the individual loss should also not be forgotten, and the loss of individual people who themselves may be not that important in the grand scheme of things, nonetheless are remembered here as well. The next thing we recite is
Chof Dalet in the article editions Al Churban Beis Hamikdash Kihura Sufihudash. It's in different orders in different places. This is a kina again by Rosa Kalir, which describes not only the structure of the Beis Hamikdash but the heavenly Beis Hamikdash as well. There's a concept of a Beis Hamikdash being in the heavens, and therefore that's referenced here, as well as certain aspects of the Klei HaMikdash, or that's detailed elsewhere. Here there's a reference at the beginning to Espod B'chol Shana V'Shana Mispeid Chodosh. Every single year we have to have a Mispeid Chodosh. Again, that's because Kol Dor Shel Nivne Beis HaMikdash V'Yom Kol Nechrom V'Yomov. And so therefore we have to have a new Hesped from basically the Kodesh and the Mikdash, and describes really the plundering of the different vessels of the Mikdash. One of the things that's mentioned, I alluded to it yesterday, Charles Shudas, it says they came in, they saw the Kruvim, Hotziva Kruvim, and Hine Kechola Goyim Beis Yehuda Chashuvim. They made fun of the Jewish people because when they saw the Kruvim, which seemed to be in the shape of idols, they felt that the Jewish people were hypocritical, because here the Jewish people had always spoken against idolatry and seemed to represent the rejection of idolatry, and here you go into their holy of holy place and lo and behold what you find what seems to be idols. And so therefore they said, the Jewish people, just like everybody else, you go into their temple and their holy place, you find idols as well. But there is something else, a different angle to this, and that is that the Gemara says that the Kruvim were in an embrace with one another. There are actually different positions that the Kruvim were in on the basis of the behavior of the Jewish people. Sometimes the Kruvim faced each other. That, says the Gemara, was when the Jewish people were Osim Ritzon HaShamakom, when they fulfilled the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that was symbolized by the Kruvim facing each other and looking at each other in a loving or a positive fashion. However, when the Jewish people would not be fulfilling the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so then the Kruvim would face the other way. What's puzzling here is that when the Goyim came into the Beis Hamikdash, they saw the Kruvim facing one another, embracing one another, which they mocked because they thought it was inappropriate. In the Holy of Holies, you have a picture or depiction, statues of two figures embracing. It's a little bit, seems a little bit embarrassing or belittling. But leaving that part of it out, isn't it strange that the Kruvim were facing each other? If this is the Churban Beis Hamikdash, Jewish people being destroyed, one would have expected that because the Jewish people were being wicked, were not fulfilling the mitzvah of the Torah, were Einam Ritzosim Ritzon HaShamakom, so why should the Kruvim be facing each other? The other rabbi, they should be in the opposite direction. So there are different answers. One is that at the very end, the Jewish people began to do tshuva. It's too late to avert this particular decree, but they began to do tshuva, and therefore the Kruvim had turned around. By the time the Goyim came in, the Kruvim were facing each other because there was this notion of HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepting the beginnings of the people's tshuva. In addition, there is the notion of, even if they weren't osim and tzon shomokom, but the fact that they were being punished itself takes away, they were being repaid for their deeds, so now things can restore to where they were before. But I think that the ultimate idea may be, getting back to this point of Imo Anochi B'tzara, because Baruch Hu lets them know, I'm taking care of you, okay, I still love you. And it's true, the Kruvim shouldn't have been facing each other, but they do at this particular point, especially as a means of communicating to the Jewish people the message that that in fact HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not abandoning them even in this dark time. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is still there, and that's the message that carries us through Golos. It's interesting, there are hints every now and then to the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know, the story is that when Yosef was sold to Mitzrayim by the brothers and was taken out of the pit and so on, so it said that the traveling Yishmaelim and Midjanim who were coming by were selling various types of spices and perfumes. So the Farshim notes That's not usually the type of stuff that these people sold. They usually were dealing with it, tar and other things which are foul smelling. So it was a bracha for Yosef, so to speak, that he got sold to people who were for traveling down to Mitzrayim with sweet smelling spices and fragrances and so on and so forth. That's what the Rebbe says. Now, if you stop and think about it, it's a little bit strange. Like, you know, did that make him feel better? Here was Yosef, he's 17 years old. He's taken away from his family, sold by his own brothers into slavery. Oh, but don't worry, at least it'll smell good on the trip. You know, it's almost, I mean, that didn't seem to be the problem. I mean, did he even notice it? What was the purpose of that? Here, this terrible tragedy is befalling him, but at least we'll make sure that there's not an offensive smell in the caravan or in the wagon when they're being taken down. But the answer is yes, that's an os l'tova. Yes, it's a tragic moment, but you know what? When there's something there that's positive, even if it's a minor thing, it says, you know what? Kodesh Baruch Hu said to Yosef, I'm still with you. I'm not averting the whole decree. I'm not canceling what's taking place to you. What's happening is happening, but I'm letting you know that I'm still here. How do you see that? Something unusual, something a little bit off. There's a pleasant smell over here when there ordinarily wouldn't have been. So the same thing, perhaps in the time of the Churban, that yes, the Beis Hamikdash is being destroyed, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu leaves a little oath, a little sign, the Kruvim are facing each other, as if to, the Goyim again make fun of it, the attackers make fun of it, but that's a sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu leaves a little sign that he hasn't abandoned us completely. Al Churban Beis Hamikdash, Ki Yehuron V'Yehuron. Next kin of Chafei is Mitein Rosh Yimayim, which again is a detailed kina relating to the period of the Crusades. We introduced it briefly before, but this one is, I guess, the more famous one, or the lengthier one. This kina was composed by Clonus Ben Yehuda, who was from a famous family, a number of different Clonuses. One is quoted, Ralph pointed out, it's quoted by Rashi one place, and this was a author. This kin was a descendant of that that family, and basically this kin describes the massacres of the German communities, the great German communities of Magenta, Spira, and Varmiza, the Mayence, Worms, and Spires, which suffered tremendously during the Crusades. In fact, as Soloveitchik pointed out, not with regards to this kingdom, I think an earlier kingdom, Soloveitchik pointed out that Germany was in the time of the early Rishonim, Germany was the greater Torah center in terms of of scholarship than France. And all the Balei HaTosfos, the early Balei HaTosfos that we have, I mean, the Tom and the Ri and so on, were from France, because we don't have any more the works of the Balei HaTosfos of Germany, the early Balei HaTosfos of Germany. Because those communities were wiped out during the Crusades, so the people were wiped out, their works were wiped out. We don't have anything left from that period, from the people of that period. Just imagine, if we think about for a moment the Torah Baal Peh, Gemara, being so centered around Rashi and Tosfos when we study. The fact is, all the Tosfos that we have are from the French. The French Balei HaTosfos, and while the French also the French Jews also suffered during the Crusades, many Jews were killed in the Second Crusade. Especially, the situation in France was simply not as terrible as it was in Germany. In Germany, there was a total destruction of the Jewish communities and of the Talmud Chacham, the Balei HaTosfos there. It's interesting. Again, the Rav pointed out that originally there was not much Torah in France. Rashi himself, Rashi lived in the time of the First Crusade. It was Rashi who turned France into a Torah center. When he was young, before the Crusades, Rashi had no yeshiva in France to study with. He went to study in Germany. Rashi sometimes refers to his Rebbeim, Yaakov Yitzchak ben Elazar HaLevi. Rashi from time to time quotes his Rebbeim. But he learned by the Talmid Chacham in Germany. He came back is when he built France into a Torah center, and his children, his grandchildren, the Balei HaTosfos, the Ri, and so on. But the German community having been wiped out, those three great cities, Magenta, Spira, and Hormizum, Mainz, Spire, and Worms, those Jews were murdered, and all of their works and so on were lost, is why we know nothing about them. But that's what this kinnah refers to, Mitain Roshi Mayim, again, probably a reference to the Second Crusade. You look carefully, again, the dates, it mentions that it inspired, it was Basheni Bishmonovo, the second day of the eighth day of the second month. In Vermeiza, it mentions the 23rd of the third month. Also reference to Shavuos, that some of these tragedies happened on. So you see, it was in the springtime, as I mentioned earlier. One other point I want to mention with regards to this kina, it says, V'chi ein lahosif moed shever v'sav era. This kina indicates that we don't have a special day, despite the tremendous suffering of the Crusades, and it didn't happen on Tisha B'Av. It happened, as we just said, you know, in the springtime, Iyar, Sivan time. Nonetheless, we mourn it on Tisha B'Av. That's why the Rav Soloveitchik and others, and the Rav also mentioned this, that you know, we don't have necessarily a special day, or we say special kinos for the Holocaust, for other tragedies. Yes, the Israeli government established Yom HaShoah, the 27th of Nisan, but there are many in the observant community, not that they didn't want to commemorate the Shoah, but we commemorate on Tisha B'Av. We'll say later, that's why we have kinnahs, a kinnah composed by the Baba Rebbe, the old Baba Rebbe, a kinnah composed by Schwab, and others composed their kinnos to commemorate the Shoah, but we say it on Tisha B'Av, because Tisha B'Av is the day when we mourn, and B'chi'ein Lahosif Moed Shemir Taveri. We don't add more days of kinnos, maybe other days when we mourn things, and certainly people from particular communities can mourn, but in terms of a national day of commemoration, that's what it says in this kinna, Ein Lahosif Moed Shemir Taveri. So continue now with this kinna, Meet Rosh Hashanah. The next kinnah goes back to Bais Rishon time, and based on a medrash, it begins Chavav Oz Baloch Yirmiyahu Al Kivrei Avos. This is based on the notion that Yirmiyahu, although interestingly enough, he's told a number of times in Sefer Yirmiyahu, we find that HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Yirmiyahu not to daven to him and so on, but Reza Kalir authored this kinnah as a sort of a presentation of the tefillah that Yirmiyahu said to try and get the Avos to wake up, and even though he personally perhaps didn't want to daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, was told not to, was instructed not to, but here at least he can get the Avos to come and wake up, so to speak, and daven for the Churban to be averted. And so that's what this kin is about, Oz Baruch Yirmiyahu Al Kivrei Avos. And each one of the Avos, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and so on, get up and petition HaKadosh Baruch Hu and say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, here's, look what we did, and we stuck with you, and so on and so forth, so how can you let this happen to our children? But HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't listen until the end, when, at least according to the version we have here, and we're familiar more with the version that only Rachel's tefillos were answered, Rachel, Avaka, Abana, and so on, and was Rachel's tefillos, that's the pasuk in Sefer Yirmiyahu, Taka. But here it mentions not just Rachel, but other Yemos as well. Kol b'chilea, misofefes, alavei, Rachel, achos, amakor, b'nei, v'zilpa, amakor, f'na, bila, mekonez, b'sei, adel. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu listens to at least all four of these Yemos, Rachel, Lea, Bila, and Zilpa, and then says I'll return your children from exile. Actually, you could read the last stanza, Shuvu Tzvinu Nuchasnem, that he was talking to all of them. Yitzhak accepted all of them, not just the most, but he answered all of them. So it's a question of, well, exactly, perhaps there were different versions of the Medrash. Perhaps Rachel's Tzvilas were the most intense, or the most focused on. But in any event, HaKadosh Baruch Hu eventually accepts the Tzvila. And he writes, or the kinnah writes, Rachti Bovelo Lemanchem, again the notion of Imanochi Mitzor that we've already now mentioned a couple of times, HaKadosh Baruch Hu also is in the Golos together with us. He doesn't abandon us. And that's why it says in the end, Shalachti, you know, where Kalmokum Shagol Yisrael, Golos Hashchino Emoyim, every place where the Jewish people were exiled, HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes along with us. So that's what this Kina mentions. And Yirmiyahu, of course, is the tragic prophet. Yirmiyahu is a Navi who witnessed the destruction on Yageva Ro'oni. And some suggest he was initially embarrassed to go to the Kibrei Avos and Davin because basically there'd be an indictment of him. You know, none of this happened under our watch, the other Avos would say, right? It happened under your watch. And he was embarrassed about it. But none, and Yirmiyahu was Navi who suffered greatly in his life. I mean, he was mocked and he was persecuted. He wasn't listened to and really had a very, very difficult... He had really, in a certain sense, the most difficult mission of all the Nevi'im, because he had to not only announce, but witness the Churban himself. And so, but nonetheless, Yirmiyahu holds up, so to speak, and goes to the Avos and eventually secures the promise of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he'll indeed return the Jews in exile. Ha'oz Baruch Yirmiyahu HaKibrei Avos. Next Kina, Chav Zayin. Husband Lo Sefek Yofa Kasirtz also tells a story about Yirmiyahu Hanavi coming and meeting up with a woman, appears to be an elderly woman, but yet she has certain indications that she comes from a nobility, from a great past, but now looks poor and disheveled. And this, of course, represents Knesset Yisrael. There's plenty of past glory, but now only poverty and looking terrible. The idea is that internally there is a beauty to Knesset Yisrael even in a time of suffering. Some will place this kinna before the last one because the very end of the kinna it says it says Leich Kuala Avos Aaron Moshe. Yirmiyahu is sent to go petition to the Avos. We just read that in the previous kinnah. So some have this in the reverse order, in some editions it makes a certain amount of sense, obviously. But anyway, getting back to what this kinnah is about, Soloveitchik pointed out that really this is a typical of the Jewish people, that we look beaten and disheveled, that we look poor and dirty and so on and so forth, but there's a certain inner type of beauty. This woman at the same time was a beautiful woman, but at the same time she was repulsive looking. And the Rav pointed out there's a Mishnah in Darim which says that there was a story that a man was being pressured by family members to marry a certain woman whom he found unattractive. So he took a nether, and that's why it appears in the Darim, he took a nether that he would be forbidden to this woman. Later on, this woman was taken in and bathed and dressed in nice clothing, and her whole appearance changed, and he didn't realize it was the same woman. She looked so different. He didn't realize it was the same person, and he regretted now the fact that he'd taken his nether. So Rabbi Shmuel was able to be mater the nether because he said, had you known that this was the same woman, would you have taken the nether? And he certainly said no. And Rabbi Shmuel then broke into tears and he said, that's the story of Knesset Yisrael. The Jewish women are always beautiful. They're always attractive. However, poverty and suffering makes us look unattractive. And again, as the Rav pointed out, it's not a message regarding only that particular story, and it's not referring to physical beauty, but intrinsically, Knesset Yisrael has a certain, all the people of Knesset Yisrael, men and women, have a certain intrinsic beauty, but the suffering and the galus and so on takes it over, and our aveiros take it over, and that becomes something that sullies us, that makes us filthy. But there's always the possibility of tshuva, and that pasuk appears, I'm just adding on, I don't think the Rav quoted it, but the pasuk in yesterday's Haftarah, right? It says, in yuchat echem kashonim, even if your sins are bright red, they're stained and so on, kashelig albino, eventually can be made white, in avimu chatova, katsemer you, if again, the color of the crimson from the worms, they can be like white, like the wool of a sheep, and so on. So it's only on the outside. That's what the Rav pointed out. In the early part of the 1900s, there were many Jews who unfortunately were tested in terms of their Shmiras Shabbos by having to go to work, because if they didn't go to work on Shabbos, they came in on Monday, didn't have a job. We can't relate to that today. Today, you know, the Shomer Shabbos programs and Shomer Shabbos this, and it's illegal in the United States to, you know, to
punish a worker for Sabbath observance. It wasn't always like that. There are many, many cases. And the Rav, I remember, this I don't think is written in the Kinnis book, but the Rav, I remember the Rav once saying that he was, you know, met people like that who were lamented. They knew they really shouldn't go to work on Shabbos. They couldn't starve, they couldn't withstand any style. But as soon as it was possible for them to get another job, they got another job and they were able to observe Shabbos. They had the longing, they had the commitment, they couldn't withstand any style. Many did, but many did not. But it wasn't out of a sense of the rejection of Chas V'Shalom of Shabbos at that time. Maybe for some it was. But for many of these people, they weren't rejecting Shabbos, they weren't rejecting religion, they weren't rejecting Yiddishkeit. Just they had this terrible Nisayon, and who knows which of us would be able to withstand the Nisayon, you know, when you have hungry children or children need to be clothed and so on, it's the only job you can get. But again, he spoke of people who had to do it, or they felt they had to do it. I'm not analyzing it now from a halachic point of view, it's not the point here. But they violated Shabbos, they went to work on Shabbos, perhaps violating as little as possible, but as soon as the opportunity presented itself, you know, to get a different type of job, then they grabbed it. Of course they wanted to observe Shabbos. And that's what the Rav said, sometimes circumstances make us dirty externally and you know, make us look bad on the outside, but on the inside there's this internal beauty, and that's what's referenced in this kin as well. The next Hevel, also as a Kalir, ends with each stanza ends with a frustrating comment. How can I possibly be comforted? And there's a list of various different sorrows that befell the Jewish people at the hands of different enemies. And I guess if we had to pick one phrase that's familiar to us from the Haggadah that would perhaps apply over here, it's B'chol Dar V'Dar Omdim Aleinu L'Chaloseinu. It's not just in one generation, not just one time, but in every generation there are people who come against us, and hence the references in this particular kinnah to Nebuchadnezzar, to other Babylonians, to the Romans, to Madai, to the Greeks, to Edom, and just one, as it says, the very end of the kinnah, Tsaros al Tsaros, one sorrow, one disaster, one tragedy on top of another. And that really, again, to a certain extent, has been the history of the Jewish people down to the present time. It's interesting that some of the events seem to be out of order. The Romans are mentioned before Madai and before Greece. It's out of order. Then it comes back. And the Rav said, that's a symbol of Avelis. A person who's an Avel, his memory gets mixed up. Things fly into your head. You ever visited somebody who was sitting shiva, or fortunately you had the opportunity to sit shiva yourself, you recall events, and there's no order, because you're not thinking clearly. A person who's really in mourning is not able to construct things clearly in his head. The Avelis has taken over. So he said that's symbolic of what Elazar Kalir does here, said the Rav. He presented it out of order because it's almost a stream of consciousness which is not necessarily organized in the in the correct chronological order. And again, it ends with the frustration of Eich Nechama, but still, at the very end, with all of that, there is a notion of Ba'oz and Achaim. Eventually, the time will come when we will be able to be comforted. Kino Chostes, Amarti, Shumeni, Shumeni, B'chem Arer. Again, there's another kina that describes the suffering of the Jews in the time of the Crusades. This was also composed by one of the members of the Columbus family. Again, the martyrdom and the suffering in the time of the Crusade. It's a relatively long kinnah. And basically the phrase, for example, it summarized the idea that even though they were going to destroy the fight against the Muslims who occupied the Holy Land, and nevertheless, they figured on their way they can take care of the Jews as well. They said to themselves, why don't we first get rid of the Jewish people? That was really the whole idea of the Crusades, which should not really have impacted the Jews at all. If their mission was, at the direction of the Pope, to go to Eretz Israel to take over the Christian holy place in the hands of they considered the non-believing Muslims, what's it got to do with the Jews? Why have the Jews had nothing to do with it? Why should the Crusades have turned into something that was so terrible to the Jewish people? The call of the Pope was to go to the Promised Land, to go to the Holy Land and redeem or rescue the Christian holy sites from the hands of the Muslims who were in control of the land. So what's it got to do with the Jews? However, the feeling was, again, as I said before, well, we're on our way to fight those non-believers. We've got Jews right over here. Let's take care of them too. And again, that's the
theme of this kina, the suffering and the martyrdom of the time of the Crusades. The next kina, kina lamed, begins Ma'onei Shemayim Shechokim is Belucha, refers to the destruction of the physical building of the Beit HaMikdash. The word bias appears at the end of each stanza, based on different psukim and different places where the word bias appears in Tanakh, because there was, of course, the physical destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. It begins with a reference to the idea that a Kadosh Baruch Hu cannot be contained in the heavens, certainly not in the bias. That was a statement made by Shlomo HaMelech. Look in Malachim Aleph, Parakas, after Shlomo HaMelech built the first Beit HaMikdash. There was a whole dedication ceremony that took place at that time, and the dedication ceremony, I guess then as now, included a speech. And so Shlomo HaMelech made a speech, a tefillah as well, and the speech said that really a Kadosh Baruch Hu can't really be contained in this bias. That's where the phrase of Afkia bias comes from, in the opening stanza. Nonetheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was mitzamtzem himself. You find this in the Medrash in Parshas Truma also. The notion of tzimtzum, we usually associate that with Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic concept. The notion of tzimtzum does appear in, I guess we call Migla as well, in the Joshim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was, so to speak, mitzamtzem himself. He limited himself to be able to be the Shekhinah contained in the Mishkan, subsequently in the Beis HaMikdash, but it's the Beis HaMikdash was at the end of the day just a house, it was just a building. And once there was no more relationship between Klal Yisrael and the Jewish people, so the Beis HaMikdash per se didn't have sanctity. And this calls to mind the comment that the Chazal make, that the Gemara makes, that once when our enemies, both the Babylonians and the Romans, destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, they were really destroying only Eitzim Vavonim, Shavah Chamoso, Al Eitzim Vavonim. Because Rav Paul that poured out his riach against stone and wood. What do you mean stone and wood? It's the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah, but once the Shekhinah departs the Beis HaMikdash, once it's already been profaned, so there's nothing really special about it in some ways. That's the notion of Bobo Pritzim Chilua. The Pritzim came in there with Mechala of the Beis HaMikdash. In fact, it relates a little bit to the notion of observing Tisha B'Av on the 9th of Av as opposed to on the 10th of Av. We mentioned over Shabbos that there were those who said, why do we observe Tisha B'Av, why do we observe the 9th of Av? Most of the Beit HaMikdash was burnt on the 10th of Av. Starkly speaking, it was set fire to on the 9th of Av, but it did not continue to burn, and most of it burnt on the 10th of Av. That's why some of the Nehuga Avelos continue into the 10th of Av, after Tisha B'Av. Not this year, because today is the 10th of Av. But when Tisha B'Av is on another day, not on Shabbos, so we observe Tisha B'Av back on the 9th of Av. So the next day, the day after Tisha B'Av, we don't yet shave and various other Nehuga, the 9 days remain in effect until midday, because that's when the Beis HaMikdash was burning. So why wasn't Tisha B'Av established on the 10th of Av? So some of the Tanaim said, yes, I would have been there, Ataka would have established on the 10th of Av. The others said, no, we go by Tchilas HaPeronos, we go by the beginning of the trouble was on the 9th. But more than that, one could argue that once they came into the Beis HaMikdash, so it lost its kedush anyway. So what was continued to burn overnight and into the next day was just Eitzim Ravonim. It's just a bias. Nonetheless, this kind of calls our attention to the physical destruction of the Beis HaMikdash edifice. The next kina, the famous Eishtukat Kirbi, kina Lamed Aleph, mentioned before the connection between Yetzias Mitzrayim and Yetzias Yerushalayim. And again, as I mentioned before, I think that the recitation of kinas that we've been doing this morning is like the recitation of the Haggadah. It gives an opportunity to create a certain atmosphere and to recall and to relive those events. But here there's a contrast, or contrast that is drawn between leaving Mitzrayim and leaving Yerushalayim, the glory, everything triumphant, everything beautiful when we leave Mitzrayim, the exact opposite when we leave Yerushalayim. I don't think the author of this kina is known. All these books that I've checked say this kina is of unknown authorship, but it's easy to understand. There's nothing in most of the words that he's understand, and we can focus on the contrast, let's say, between Oz Yoshir Moshe and Vayikone and Yirmiyahu, Moshe singing and Yirmiyahu lamenting, or Chagim B'Shabbosos and Tainus Ve'Evel,
again, opposite kinds of themes, and that's the notion of tasting the triumph, tasting Yerushalayim. Nothing, no simcha that we have is complete in the absence of Yerushalayim. In fact, there's someone point out that even the Pesach Seder, I'm more right, that even the Pesach Seder itself, one of the items that we have on the Kara, on the Seder plate, is an egg. And it doesn't say that the Mishnah speaks about Shnei Tavshilin. The Mishnah speaks about two cooked items on the Seder plate, huh? Yeah, right. And the example that the Gemara gives, don't mention eggs, or rice and beets, or some type of fish, different things, you know, it's two different types of meat, according to one opinion. So there's a lot to say about that, not for today. But, you know, it doesn't mention an egg. The minhag is to have an egg as one of the items on the Seder plate, and there are more. Right, so that's because, as I mentioned before, Tisha B'Av is always the same day of the week as Pesach in that particular year. And again, this year it's because of Pesach. Tisha was pushed off a day, but technically it landed on Shabbos, which is the first day of Pesach on Shabbos. And so we remind ourselves on the Pesach Seder that even the Pesach Seder, the night of glory, is incomplete because we don't have the Beis Hamikdash. So Rambam Gaon objects to this reason. There in the Bir HaGroa and Hilchos Pesach, he says, not correct, we should bring up our Avelus at the Seder. Nonetheless, there are posts who say that. And that's the idea, again, sort of reminding ourselves of Yerushalayim, even at the time of, you know, of the Seder, or the notion of Aros Simchasi. It's only at the end that it turns around and says, Sosim the Simcha, Venos Yogam Anacha, Beshuvah the Yerushalayim, eventually we'll have the same type of Simcha, or even greater Simcha. Gemara says, based on Psukim, that when you return to Yerushalayim, that'll be even greater than the Yetzias Mitzrayim. The Yetzias Mitzrayim becomes secondary to the returning to Yerushalayim, and that's what this kina expresses the hope for at the very end.
The Taysim in Mitzrayim, Yotzim u'bonim v'ochrim v'kolim v'tesim v'yushalayim Lo sheyireinu v'aron yalcheinu v'tesim v'mitzrayim Rucha netzar v'adyamos kesar v'tesim v'yushalayim Narok v'choma v'adonai shama v'tesim v'mitzrayim
Sai Shofu has as its refrain the phrase Oyad Oy Mehe Olanu. This kin is attributed to one of the Balei Atosos in the 13th century, Baruch of Magenza. It was sometimes quoted by other Rishonim among the Ashkenazim, and it has the phrase Oyad Oy Mehe Olanu, just an expression again of woe. This particular kinna also describes some of the beauty of Yerushalayim. In that sense, it continues the previous kinna. When we betaste in Yerushalayim, we had all the suffering, but here it mentions the beauty of Yerushalayim and the what it was like when the city was what it was before the Korban. Of course, now that's all gone, and then hence the phrase Oy Mehelano and Oya. For the change in the Megillas Eicha, it says Zachor Yerushalayim Me'anyo Mudel. Yerushalayim remembers Zachor Yerushalayim Me'anyo Mudel. Remembers the days of its suffering and tragedy, but Kol Machmadel also remembers its beauty. So part of the kinos is not only to remember the taste in Yerushalayim, you know, what happened when we left, but to remember the beauty of Yerushalayim as well. And that is the theme of this kino. Etzvos Aishofu. Well, the next kinah, Lamed Gimel, continues this very same theme related to the Crusades. Again, the phrase here is Oyoli and Alalili. I just want to point out one interesting thing about this kinah. Many times in the kinos, as other people to follow the order of the Aleph phase we mentioned earlier, that's what Yirmiyahu and Avi did in Eicha. Eicha follows the Aleph phase. And many piyutim, not only from Tisha B'Av kinos, but also throughout the year. The other theme that we often find in the setup of kinos and of piyutim is something to do with the name of the author. In other words, the author hinted his name was an acrostic. I guess the famous one that most people know from the time they were young is L'cha Dodi, which of course Friday night, so it's written by Shlomo HaLevi Alkavitz. So each of the stanzas, L'cha Dodi, the first letter of each stanza, if you look at each stanza, it spells out the name Shlomo HaLevi.
In this particular Akdamus, you know, Akdamus has a double Aleph Beis, and it has a long description of the name of also the author. But here, just to point it out, after the Aleph Beis, you have a the person's name, Menachem Reb Mocher. It was an important family in Magensa. The name Mocher family we find discussed among the Rishonim. This kinnah is about the crusade, the first crusade, 1096, of which he was a survivor, but he signs his name Anochi Menachem Ha'olov Barab Mocher. He doesn't say Menachem Barabi Mocher, that's his name, but Menachem Ha'olov. Now, Olov can have a number of different meanings. It can mean lowly or unworthy, but also means, it could mean beaten, like Hamelov Menem Olvim, somebody who has suffered. And I don't know, but perhaps he wrote that because of his feeling of his life and having seen so much suffering. And again, this kinnah with the refrain, oily and alalili, woe is to me, wail unto me, and so on. He described himself, he signed his name that way. It's somewhat unusual. I don't know enough about Piyutim to know whether it's extremely rare to find that or not, but just it strikes me over here. You can see if you look at your cross at the very end of the kinnah, that's how he describes himself as Menachem Ha'olov, someone who was, again, perhaps suffered, and that's how he almost identified himself because of what he had seen during the time of the Crusades. The next kinnah, Lamedalad, Yom Achpi Ichbarti, is the famous kinnah about the story of the Navi and the Kohen Zechariah ben Yehoyada, who was, when he objected to bringing a pestle, an idol into the Beis HaMikdash, was stoned to death by fellow Jews, and is murdered in the Beis HaMikdash. He was an innocent person, was a Kohen, a Navi. This happened on Yom Kippur. It was also Shabbos that year, and according to the story, as we know, the blood of Zechariah lay for a long time on the floor, the ground of the Beis HaMikdash, where it had been spilled, and it continued to bubble. And years later, when the Babylonian general Nebuzaradan came in and saw the bubbling blood, he thought something was strange about this, and he asked about it. And again, a story appears in the Gemara in a couple of places. And basically, as Rav Soloveitchik said, it's similar to what HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Cain at the time after he killed Hevel, called me'achicha tzorekim elayim min ha'adama, and the voice of your brother, sound of your brother's blood is calling out to me from the ground. So here too, the shedding of innocent blood demands justice. And Zechariah's blood boiled and seethed until it was rather than slaughtered, many, many thousands of people over this blood to try and blot it out, so to speak, until it finally stopped. And eventually it was rather than tshuva and actually converted according to the tradition as according to the Gemara and Gittin Daf Nun Zayin. It's an interesting question as to why this kinnah is brought up here towards the end of the recitation of kinnos. It happened in the earlier stage in time of the Bayis Rishon. It would have been appropriate to mention perhaps earlier. Rav Soloveitchik suggested that it's dafka because of the theme of tshuva, that's hidden at the very end. Because after the Nebuzaradan saw the sort of might of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and somehow was able to speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and say, you want me to kill more people, and finally it stopped, somehow he was moved to do tshuva. One never knows what moves somebody to do tshuva. However, the Rav pointed out that even such a murderer, right, who slaughtered men, women, and children by the thousands, in fact represented evil and cruelty at that time, was able to do tshuva, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepted the tshuva. In that sense, the Rav thought this would be an appropriate thing to recite in Yom Kippur, trying to focus on the power of tshuva. And the Rav uses as a means of sort of highlighting that tshuva is to some extent at least a hidden theme of Tisha B'Av as well. Obviously the theme of Tisha B'Av is Avelis. The Rav in a different context noted that Tisha B'Av really is a confluence of at least two different themes. There's Avelis and there's Tainus. He described the two parts of the day in that fashion. The morning, the theme is Avelis. And the afternoon of Tisha B'Av, when it's already mutter to sit on a chair, Tisha B'Av becomes more like a regular kind of tzibur, a little bit we spoke about in the shiur before Meir last night about Tisha B'Av in some ways being parallel to the other three fasts of Tamidalia, of Masada Tavis, and of Shavas Batamus. But be that as it may, in this sense, the Rav mentioned that the tshuva is to some extent a hidden theme, perhaps a not so hidden theme of Tisha B'Av as well, because once we've recognized, as we identified in earlier kinos, in earlier kinos, that what happened is our fault, that's the first step towards tshuva, is akoras achet, recognizing sin and admitting it. And in fact, some of the famous psukim relating to tshuva are found in Megillas Eicha, specifically in Paragimel Pasuk Mem, not Pasod Rachenim and Akkorah, then Oshuva Ad Hashem, right? We have to investigate our ways and check out our deeds and do tshuva. Okay, and we ask the Kodesh Baruch take us back to tshuva. Shemein Hashem Alecha v'no tshuva. So tshuva is to a certain extent a theme of Tisha B'Av as well. In fact, the Rav stressed that the Rambam in the fifth parak of Hilchos Tshuva describes the notion of Bechira Chavshis, and again uses Psukim from Megillas Eicha as the source for the notion that a person has free choice. It's not up to God. God does not determine whether a person is good or bad. And each person has his own free will. And that's the notion of tshuva, which again becomes to some extent a theme of Tisha B'Av. And it can be accomplished even by the most wicked of people. So whether it's the Buzrazan here, or it's Menashe, or other people who throughout history may have done tshuva at the end, there's a theme here that HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepts our sincere tshuva, and therefore on Tisha B'Av, not just on Kippur, but on Tisha B'Av, when we acknowledge that all the suffering befell us because of our own sins, so it's appropriate to bring up as well the notion of Tisha B'Av here, of tshuva here on Tisha B'Av. Here in this, again, the overwhelming theme is the story of the killing of the Navi, Zechariah, and Bayerim, Basihuda, Tani, Raniah. He increased so much suffering, so much mourning, but again, he had so much groaning, and even there, even he was able to do tshuva at the end. Yom Ach, Bichbarati, Vaichbulavani, Bishokhiya. The king which you just read was composed by Rabbi Yehuda Levi, and as is the one following, number 34, the one that follows this one, 36, is also by Ruda Levi. But in between, we have Kina Lamed Hei, Shkuras Velo Miyayim, which is not composed by Ruda Levi. I'm not sure why it's put in here, but basically, it's just a recounting of the frustration of the Jewish people being Shkuras, drunk, but not because of wine, but rather because of suffering. And again, just a summary of some of the tragedies which are observed on Tisha B'Av, and just in the general notion of of suffering overall. Now, what's interesting is, again, the notion of tshuva is found here. It says, how can you complain? Your sin is well known. Because of your many sins, the nation was exiled, and so on. So again, the notion, perhaps, of tshuva fits in here. The last stanza is a very, very sharp, basically message to our enemies, saying that eventually we will witness that Kodesh Baruch Hu punishes you the way he punished us. So a brief kinna kind of summarizing the suffering, the notion of tshuva, and the notion that ultimately Kodesh Baruch Hu will punish those who have oppressed us. The next kinna. Tzion, Ali Sarahosi Shalu Soma Sirayach, is the first of a series of kinos that begin with the word Tzion. This one, perhaps the most famous, written by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. We know the story of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and his great desire to come to Eretz Yisrael. There are different stories. Again, we don't know the historical accuracy of the story. The famous stories when he came to Eretz Yisrael. He got off his horse and got down to kiss the ground and was trampled. Subsequently, again, there are issues of whether it's an accurate story or not. But one thing is for sure, that Yehuda Levi had a great longing to be in Eretz Yisrael, and describes Eretz Yisrael with a certain beauty and the place of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and many, many references based on Midrashim that appear in this kinah. The beginning I mean, just to give an example, you know, there's reference to Avir Artzeich, right, the very air of Eretz Yisrael, the concept of Avir Dara Machin, and so on. But the beginning of the Kina, I said, Tzion Halo Sishali Lishlom Asirayef, is Yusha question. You know, is Yushalayim concerned with, you know, with the fate or the well-being of the people who live there and so on? The idea is that it should be because the Jewish people, you know, love the land, they're loyal to Tzion, they don't want to be the Aris Sirayef, the land has captured them. Okay? That's why Yudalevi refers to the people as Tzion HaLosh Asirayim, your captives. We're captivated by Eretz Yisrael. We're captivated by Yerushalayim. Just a beautiful concept that, you know, every Jew somehow is owned, if you will, or captured by Yerushalayim. The truth of the matter is, the Rav pointed out, we don't know what is meant by Tzion here, because it could refer to Yerushalayim, it could refer to the Beis HaMikdash, it could refer to Eretz Yisrael in general. It's not really clear what is being referenced here, but it could well be all of Eretz Yisrael, but also could be, again, the more limited sense of Yerushalayim. Yehuda Levi, as we said, is somebody who longed himself to go to Eretz Yisrael, and again, according to the legend, did so and met an immediate end there, but his love for Eretz Yisrael is known from this and from other piyutim as well. This kina again describes the beauty of Yerushalayim, which is important because we also we have to recognize that not only Zachor Yerushalayim Me'anyu Mudea, but also Kolmach Mudea Shoher Me'Kedin, and that accounts the references here for Tzion Klilas Yofi, the land of the city, which is so beautiful. The Gemara mentions that of all the beautiful places, Yerushalayim took 9 out of 10 measures of beauty that's in the world. Again, these kind of descriptions appear here in the land. But there's also something else. The notion of us being captured by, let's assume it refers to all of Eretz Yisrael, is true in the reverse too. Eretz Yisrael is the land of the Jews. It's captured by the Jews. The fact is that over the course of history, no other nation had success, really, in building up Eretz Yisrael. And even in the age, the great age of colonization, when European countries in the 1800s took over all parts of Africa, certain parts of the Middle East, no one was able to make a successful go of it in Eretz Yisrael. And it's just, it's a historical reality. I think I mentioned in the past that in the 1880s, Mark Twain, a great American writer, took a trip around the world, and he reported, I think in Harper's Magazine, one of the magazines, he sent in every month or whatever it was, his reports from different places that he traveled around the world, and it was published for the American, obviously this is the days before Skype, and being able to, you know, Kotokan and anything else like that, where you can go any place in the world and see on the internet. You know, in those days, it was interesting for people to read, you know, what was going on in other places in the world. And so this is what Mark Twain did. He reports about coming to the Holy Land, then called Palestine. He said there was no place that he visited that was more desolate, that was more downtrodden, that was less built up. And he realized, this is the Holy Land. He's very disappointed. And that's because the truth of the matter is, no other nation throughout the centuries was able to make a significant go of building up Eretz Yisrael. Not the Romans, not the Byzantines, the Muslims, the Crusaders. The British Empire would set it up, they could not be successful either. But the Jews, in a short period of time, what has been accomplished in Eretz Yisrael in the last 60 plus years, and even more recently, is something which is simply never, one could never predict it, and therefore we remain loyal to Tzion, to Eretz Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael has remained loyal to us as well. We'll say this next kina and the series of Tzion kinas, and I'll try and comment briefly on each one as we move towards the conclusion of the kinas. Tzion. The next kina. Sion Kichi called Tzori Gila B'Tzirayah. Again, it's written in the same style. This is not written by Yehuda Levi, but it follows the same style. And this kina also, the kina praises the natural beauty of Eretz Yisrael. and the unique quality and unique status of the natural portion of Eretz Yisrael. So for example, there's reference to the waters of Eretz Yisrael, which were able to rid Naaman of his tzaras when no other waters that he bathed in was able to do so. Even the animals of Eretz Yisrael are different. There's reference to Leven Yoyer Chamorayek, the Chamor, or Pinchas Ben Yoyer, who would not eat the food from which Tumas and Maisers weren't taken. That everybody, you know, the animals cooperated. The Mishnah Perek Avos says, Lo Hizik Nachash Ra'akar B'Yushalayim Olam. Somehow the animals that normally annoy people and bother people didn't do it, at least in Yerushalayim. And so you have a reference here, as I said, to the physical part of Eretz Yisrael, the beauty of the Anna, the physical sense, the uniqueness of every aspect of Eretz Yisrael, even the animals of the fruit. It's interesting, I think I've pointed out in the past, the Bach, the Hukos, Brichas Aperos, makes a comment that you'd expect to find maybe the Chassidish Sefer, but the Bach writes it, Lahalocha, that the very fruit of Eretz Yisrael is different, because it's Yonek, it grows from the ground which has Kedusha. That's why in Eretz Yisrael, when you make an Allah 8, after having certain fruits, it's Allah Arz Al Peiro Seho. Not Allah Arz Al Peiro, like we said, Allah Arz Al Peiro Seho. Because it's something about the fruits themselves. The Kedusha of the land is absorbed even into the fruits, and by extension, the animals and certainly the people that live there. Tzion Kefi. The next kin again, following the same pattern, is Tzion HaPeres Tzvi. Tzion HaPeres Tzvi was written by Reb Elazar, who was the son of Reb Moshe HaDarshan, that Rashi sometimes quotes. Here too, again, the specialness of Yerushalayim, the specialness of Eretz Yisrael, Tzion. Interestingly enough, here there is a reference to Yericho, and we pointed out in the past, there's a reference to Ir HaTzmarim. Ir HaTzmarim is Yericho, and it says that the Ktoris had a smell that reached all the way to Yericho. Now, if we pause and think for a moment, Yericho was the very first city that was conquered by the Jews upon entering Eretz Yisrael. Shouldn't that have been, therefore, if we assume that the first of everything belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Bikurim, everything else, the first Pidyon HaBen, and the son Peter, Peter Chamor, and son Peter Seh, if the first of everything goes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so wouldn't it have made sense that the first place that the Jewish people conquered, Yericho, should have been the place that was designated as the city of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Or alternatively, why didn't they conquer Yerushalayim first? All right, so geographically they were closer to Yericho. The fact is, they didn't know at that point yet that Yerushalayim was a designated place. But why did Yericho become that place? It's a little bit unclear. The answer is that's not the place that Hashem designated, and that's it. But there is some kedusha, so to speak, that Yericho has as well. The Gemara says in Yuma that the smell of the Ktoris reached all the way to Yericho, but the Ravid comments in Maseches Tamid on the Aflam, it doesn't mean that the smell of the Ktoris reached all the way to Yericho. It was perceptible in Yericho, not all the way to Yericho, but Yerushalayim and Yericho. Yericho maintained some special status, miraculously, and the truth of the matter is that Yerushalayim was lo nischalka l'shvatim. Yerushalayim didn't belong to any one particular shevet. So what happened was, when they conquered Yericho, the descendants of Yisrael were given Yericho to hold on to as caretakers, I guess would be the right word, until once Yerushalayim was established as the place of the Makom HaMikdash and the capital of the Jewish people. So no Shevet had control of Yerushalayim, so the Shevet from which Yerushalayim was quote unquote taken was given Yericho as a compensation, so to speak. So Yericho is very, very closely connected to Yerushalayim. Again, the children of Yisrael, the family of Yisrael, held on to it as caretakers, but once Yerushalayim became designated, so those people in whose lot Yerushalayim would have fallen, but now it's on his heart, Ashvatim, was not divvied up, it was everybody's territory, so then as compensation they were given Yericho. So there is this deep connection between Yericho and Yerushalayim. There's also reference in his kinah, we spoke about previously, Eser Kedushos, the 10 levels of Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. But again, I just wanted to highlight that notion of the specialness of Yericho and its connection to Yerushalayim. And the Kinnah ends by saying, "Is over really cross Dode." basically a call to Yerushalayim to wake up, because your beloved in HaKadosh Baruch Hu will soon return. The next Kinnat Zion to Konni Ale Vesech Hashem Nisraf is a petition to Zion itself to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to return and so on, and ultimately at the end of the kina, a request to find the Avos and the Imos. Again, we had that kina earlier where Yirmiyahu went to the Maris HaMachpelah to wake up the sleeping Avos to get them to daven. Here there's a call for Tzion itself to continue to petition the Avos for assistance. Again, there's reference here at the end to Rachel, Leah, Bilah, and Zilpah. It's not just Rachel, despite the Psukim and Yirmiyahu that speak about the voice of Rachel being the one which ultimately convinced HaKadosh Baruch Hu to return, or was in Meshav Uvanim L'Gvulam. Of course, according to our tradition, Rachel continues to cry. There's a famous story of Chaim Shmulevitz, a great Rashid Amir. Chaim Shmulevitz once went to Kever Rachel and said, in effect, that the Psukim in Yirmiyahu, it says, Mini Kolech Mibechi, stop crying. Right? The Kodesh Baruch Hu says to Rachel, stop crying, no need to cry anymore. He said, but I and Chaim say, cry, please cry, continue to cry. In other words, he says, Yiddish was Vine, Mama Vine, you know, wine, weep, our mother weep, the tears of Rachel should eventually pierce with heavens and the Haftacha should come true, the Shavuot one and Gvulam. This kin as well concludes with that same request. Kiru v'kol, call out loud, and Kielokim alo netzach lo'iznam, because Baruch Hu surely won't forever abandon us, ki sikvohi v'ol shalom l'vanayah, and eventually there is hope for shalom for your children, for the Jewish people. Tzion, tekoni alei beisech, Hashem Yisrael. The next kin at Tzion Yavidus Yadid, again the same pattern, seeing the praise of Yerushalayim or Tzion. The emphasis here relates to Binyamin, the notion of Yadid in the bracha of Binyamin in Sefer Zos HaBracha. It says, Binyamin Amar Yadid Hashem. That's what he's referred to as Yadid Hashem. Shlomo HaMelech is also called Yadid. And Avraham Avinu is also referred to as Yadid, the beloved. So the Gemara says in Maseches Menachos that when the Beis HaMikdash was going to be built, Kadosh Baruch Hu said, let the Yadid, who is the beloved, that Shlomo HaMelech, the son of the Yadid, descendant of Avraham Avinu, come and build the Yadid. The Beis HaMikdash is also referred to the place of love for the Yadid. The Jewish people are called Yadidim in the portion of the Yadid, right? The Chelek of the Yadid, the Shevet, the territory of the Shevet that's called Yadid, in order to bring Kapara for the Yadidim. And so that's this reference at the very beginning of this kina, the Tzion Yedidus Yedid. But there's something else as well. Binyamin was perhaps the one in whose shevet the holiest part of the Beis HaMikdash appeared, is because Binyamin was a brother who did not participate in any way in the persecution of Yosef. The sinas chinam that resulted in this korban Beis HaMikdash was not participated in by Binyamin. Unfortunately, all the concept of sinas chinam and the failure to demonstrate brotherhood is rooted in the story of Yosef and his brothers. We mentioned before that connection to Asarah and Malchus, but Binyamin had nothing to do with it, and therefore the Beis HaMikdash, which is a place Yerushalayim Kir Shechubra LaYachta, that everybody comes together, is the holiest part is in the territory of Binyamin. In addition, in terms of the second Beis HaMikdash, the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by Romans, which are identified with Edom, the descendants of Esau, and Binyamin was the one of the brothers that did not bow down to Esau when Yaakov and his children encountered them after returning in 22 years. Binyamin wasn't born yet, so he didn't participate. So for these reasons, the territory of Binyamin perhaps was selected as as the territory for the Beis HaMikdash. I mentioned before that Yerushalayim was not previously known, known to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it wasn't known to the Bnei Yisrael, to the Jewish people, as to where the city would be. In fact, they were looked in one place, and it's referenced in this kinnah to a place called Ein Etam. Ein Etam, the Gemara says, they had a svara to build the Beis HaMikdash in a place called Ein Etam. Now, why was that? Because it was the highest place, and it makes sense the Beis HaMikdash should be in the highest place, the highest mountain in that region. However, then they darshan the pasuk with regards to Binyamin. It starts the Yiriyah Hashem Yishkan, and then it says, Ubein Kseifav Shachein. The Shekhinah will be Bein Kseifav, by his shoulder. So that's what I understood. It wasn't the highest place. The shoulder is not the highest. The head is higher. So it wasn't the highest place. It was the Bein Kseifav Shachein. That's where they ultimately came to Yerushalayim. There's also reference here to, although Shlomo HaMelech built the Beis HaMikdash, the Kedusha was instilled by David HaMelech. So it was really the combination of David and Shlomo that built the Beis HaMikdash. We, of course, lament the fact, Eich Esmecha Od B'Chag, how can we ever rejoice again? And that calls to attention our attention to the Gemara at the end of Parakeska, the Batim Rav Basu, that they didn't want to do anything that reminded them of the Beis HaMikdash, including not only eat meat and wine like we do, avoid in the 9 days, not to eat fruit, not to drink water, and so many different things. Of course, they couldn't do that, but everything which reminded us of the Beis HaMikdash. So here too, when you think about the beauty of Yerushalayim, the uniqueness of it, so Eich Esmecha Od B'Chag, how can we possibly ever rejoice again, is what's mentioned in this kinnah. We continue again, Tzion Yigidus, who did number 40. The next kinnah, Mem Aleph, departs from the pattern of the Tzion kinnahs before we return to them for the very end. This is the famous kinnah of Shali Surufa Ba'esh. Shali Surufa Ba'esh refers to the Torah. Surufa Ba'esh means the Torah, which is wrapped, so to speak, or cloaked, consumed by fire, and is a call out to the Torah itself, if you will. The Torah itself is supposed to cry out, so to speak, for what has happened. This kinnah, the famous kinnah, was composed by Maram Rutenberg. Maram Meir Rutenberg, who was the Rebbe of the Rosh and of the Agos Maimonides and the Mordechai, really considered to be the last of the Balei Hatosas. Major, major figure in terms of Psak Halacha, and then Hagim, especially in terms of Ashkenazim. Again, considered to be the last of the Balei Hatosas. Many of the Minhagim that the Ramah quotes as Ashkenazic Minhagim in the Shulchan Aruch, as opposed to the Minhagim of the Sfaradim, were based on the tradition from the Talmidim of the Maram Rutenberg, again, the Rosh, the Mordechai, the Gos Maimonides, and others. The Maram Rutenberg was a witness to the famous episode of the burning of the Gemaras in Paris in the year 1242. Maram Rutenberg was an eyewitness to this. The Catholic Church wanted to eradicate the Torah Shebaal Peh, basically the Gemara, from amongst the Jews. And this was in the aftermath of the debate which took place between a gentleman by the name of Nicholas Donin, who was a Meshumad, an apostate Jew, and one of the Rishonim, Reb Chil of Paris. Again, this was in the early part of the 1200s. The great debate took place. Other famous Balei Hatosas, including Moshe Kutzi, were present in that debate. Nonetheless, the official decision, which was decided before the debate, was that the Christians had won. It was obviously predetermined that would be. And therefore, subsequent to that, a short time after that, they gathered, again in France, copies of Gemaras from people's shuls and so on. Let's understand that this is in the days before printing. So whatever copies of Gemara and other Swami have were handwritten, and over 1,200 manuscripts of the Gemara and commentaries were taken and burned in the public square in France, in Paris, in the year 1242. Again, this wasn't just this was a planned thing, and obviously much was lost. In fact, only one manuscript of the Talmud, known as the Munich manuscript, remained following this, and really the Torah Shebaal Peh could have been completely destroyed. I mean, it was really that comprehensive an event and that widespread, that wide-reaching an event, the Torah Shema Peh could really have been lost. But Kadosh Baruch Hu willed otherwise, and Torah Shema was not lost, and the individuals who represented it continued. Many of the individuals were people like Maharam Rutenberg, his dedication to learning, and his Talmidim and so on really preserved the Minhagim and preserved the Perushim, especially of the Ashkenazic Jews. And we all know what happened to Maharam Rutenberg in terms of his end. He was arrested, and he had to die in prison. They wouldn't let his body be buried. But anyway, that's for another story. But here, he wrote this kinna, which is certainly gloomy, about the loss of the of so many copies of the of Torah Shebaal Peh. And what's interesting is he throws out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu almost a challenge, Ba'eshal Hayesh Torah Chadosha. Like saying, is there another Torah? That's of course what the Christians claim. There's another Torah, there's another religion, there's a New Testament. And he kind of throws that in, and that's what's going on here also. Is there Torah Chadosha? Of course, certainly not. And you know, again, there's hope for light at the end of the tunnel, but this is the famous kinna on the burning of the Talmud in 1242 by Ram Rutenberg, Shali Serufa Ba'ish. Next kinna, Mem Beis, Tzion Tefiras Me'er, again, makes reference to, mentioned once earlier, Yerushalayim Shalmala. There's a concept of not only Yerushalayim Shalmata, that's the actual Yerushalayim, but there's also Yerushalayim Shalmala. In fact, the pasuk refers to Yerushalayim as Ke'ir Shechuvah Lo Yachtov. So not only does it make a connection between people, but Ke'ir Shechuvah Lo Yachtov creates a bond between Kadosh Baruch Hu and the Jewish people. And there's a notion of Yerushalayim Shalmala, a celestial, or heavenly Yerushalayim. And therefore, in this kinna, the Python, the author writes that the Tzion should call out, let the Yerushalayim, which is built, the Yerushalayim on high, Yerushalayim in heaven, should plead with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and to rebuild, to allow the rebuilding. Other than that, this kinna sort of is modeled in a way after the first parak in Megillas Eicha, that speaks about Yerushalayim as a widow, a woman who has lost her husband, has been abandoned by her children. I mentioned yesterday in the drosha on Shabbos that sometimes the bad predicament in which Jewish people find themselves is the result of the failure of the leaders, the dayanim, unfortunately, when they don't carry out the responsibilities in the proper fashion. In this kinna number 43, the next kinna, Mem Gimel, Tzion B'Mishpat L'Chila Imit Ma'onanayich. There is a challenge, so to speak, to Tzion to fight or argue or enter into a litigation with those who led you astray. I mentioned before that Yirmiyahu HaNavi, a tragic figure really, had a very, very difficult life, and one of the reasons he had a difficult life is because while he was delivering the Dvar Hashem, predicting the destruction of Yerushalayim, the Beis Hamikdash, and so on, there were other Nevi'im, or so-called Nevi'im, false Nevi'im, who were prophesying just the opposite. They said, no, everything's going to be fine, everything's great. Well, if you're living there, what would you rather hear? Would you rather hear from a guy who's telling you everything's terrible, everything's a disaster, and it's going to be bad news, and everything's going to fall apart? Would you rather hear from people who are telling you things are good, everything's going to be great? And so many people were led astray by so-called leaders, people who had at least followers who had leadership positions, who told them that everything's fine and they can continue to behave that way. And these corrupt the Nevi'ei Sheker and the judges also, again mentioned here, who did not judge people properly. Again, that's what the theme of yesterday's Haftarah also, the Haftarah of Shabbos Chazon, spoke about people who did not treat the widows and the orphans properly. All of this was part of the failure on behalf of the leaders, and therefore here, this kinna, the author, calls out to Tzion to sort of take the tag, those who led the people astray, and maybe the hidden messages, that you know, the Jewish people as a whole, as we alluded to earlier, are clean, are good, are beautiful, just that sometimes our eras sully us or dirty us, and if we can have the proper kinds of leaders who lead us in the right direction, then the time will come again and we'll be cleansed of these averas.
We come now to the last of the Tzion Kinos, Mandalat, before Tzion Averas and Al-Horst Mitzirayev, which simply summarizes the horrors of the Churban, and the last one, because it kind of summarizes all the different things that happened in terms of the world itself, the universe itself, and it's a call out to all parts of nature, and the sun and the moon and the constellations should all weep, because we no longer hear the simcha which was once heard, the sounds of simcha which were once heard in the Beis Hamikdash in Yerushalayim, and in general how the crowns once worn by Jews are now worn by non-Jews, and there were basically downtrodden people ever since that time, and so there's a call to return. And toward the end of the kin, it says, "Nafshi, it's like my soul yearns." Shlomach drosh yusuk chom tzach alei or ka'av tal b'chom yom neid kitzirayach. That the my soul, so to speak, yearns to return for the day when the sun will shine again, and that's the time that we'll rejoice. And it ends with the reference to Shlom Asirayach. There will be peace for all of your captives. And I think sort of forms the bookend to the very first of the Tzion Kinos, Tzion Alosh, written by Huda Levi, Tzion Alosh, Alosh Yishara, the Shlom Asirayach. So that phrase, Shlom Asirayach, which I explained before, means sort of Yerushalayim is our captive, but we're also captivated or captives of Yerushalayim. That forms the bookend of all these kinos, and hence concludes this kino as well. Tzion Givaris, Malachus Mitzirayim. I mentioned this several times earlier that whether or not a particular tragedy happened on Tisha B'Av is designated as the day to commemorate all Jewish tragedies. Therefore, our practice at this time to say two kinos in connection with the Holocaust and the suffering of the Jews in the Shoah. I don't know if everyone has the art school edition. If you do, it's page 384. There's one kina composed by the old Baba Rebbe Zichron Lebracha, Shlomo Halberstam, and one by Shimon Schwab, Zichron Lebracha, with the Breuer's Kehillah. It's important to recognize in terms of sheer numbers, so the Holocaust, many other of the tragedies pale in comparison just on a numbers level to the extermination of 6 million Jews. I don't need to document for anybody here the significance of the Holocaust. But we mentioned that we do this on Tisha B'Av because Tisha B'Av is the national day of mourning for the Jewish people. And also, as the Baba Rebbe pointed out when he composed this kinah, he did so despite feeling that he was inadequate and incomparable to people like Elazar Kalir, whose kinos recited so many of this morning. Nonetheless, he said, it says in the Sefer Seder Hayom, was it lived at the time of the Arizal and Yosef Karo, that on this day anybody who can say kinos and anybody who can compose something that's appropriate should do so. Therefore, he felt that it was okay for him to do it. And so we'll say the two kinos again. If you have the art school sitter, it's 384. We have another publication. If you want to look on with somebody else, I will say those two kinos and then conclude with Avrit Zion. Zichron Avikono Kol Yisrael. Conclude now with Tzion Mandalat 45, which basically indicates, as some of you pointed out, that even as we finished saying all the kinos, the recitation of kinos is never really complete until the Beis Hamikdash is built, and so we call upon Tzion to cry out, to wail at one last time. We say this together as a tzibur, hopefully. Comparison to Isha B'tzireha, to a woman suffering from the pangs of birth, and the silver lining there is that just as ultimately after the woman goes through the suffering of childbirth, she has, Baruch Hashem, a beautiful child, so hopefully the wailing and the crying of Tzion will be like Isha B'tzireha, that the end, the result, will be something which is good, and again, we will indeed be able to complete the kinos completely. Leitzion, Leitzion, Kimal Yisrael.
Mikdash Re'o El Yitzion V'yoreho Kimo Isha V'tiveho V'chir Suva Kadur Ashash Alma V'yom V'ho Alei Golos V'shor Seyil Pani Meshir Elise, the young, the Come on, we saw the